the drumbeat against me as someone who wants Obama to fail personally. I hope, especially with what we've seen now, I hope he fails in implementing all this. To me, this is a no-brainer. We want something to blow up here. This is not just mortgaging the future. This is a full-fledged attack on capitalism. This is a reordering and a transformation of the basic free market. We're talking about freedom that is under assault.
This Week in Radical History for the week of March 2nd. Inspiration for this piece came from the Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This Week in Radical History for March 2nd, 1877. Despite an apparent Democratic victory at the polls, the Electoral College, swayed by Republican bribery, selects Rufford B. Hayes, a Republican, as president. Supporters of Democratic Tilghman rightfully claim a stolen election. Real Bush League stuff. Also on March 2, 1899, Congress allows railroad companies blanket approval of right-of-way through all Native American lands. Without compensation, of course. Also on March 2, 1917, in Puerto Rico. U.S. President Wilson thwarts Puerto Rican independence, takes over the island, and controls its economy and fiscal aspects of the government. Wilson also signs a compulsory military service act into law, and 20,000 islanders are drafted into World War I. Welcome to America. In 1930, Gandhi begins his 200-mile march to protest the salt tax. Also on this day in radical history for 1942, acting under Executive Order 9066, General DeWitt proclaims all Japanese Americans will be required to move away from the West Coast and recommends for, quote, their own good, unquote, they should do so voluntarily. Only a small portion do so, so later this month they will make it mandatory. Also on this date, 1982, Philip K. Dick dies, American science fiction dystopia writer. He once said, the basic tool of all manipulation of reality is the manipulation of words. If you can control the meaning of words, you can control the people who must use the words.
From where Winston stood, it was possible to read, picked out on his white face in elegant lettering, the three slogans of the party. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
And when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, March 3rd in 1863, Congress passed the first draft law in United States history, authorizing the president to draft citizens into the Civil War. While most of the North supported the Union, the shortage of men enlisting in the military, especially in New York City, is what sparked this law. One of the provisions of the draft law allowed a man to exempt himself from being drafted in exchange for $300. This was controversial because $300 in 1863 was a sum of money that only rich people could afford, and the war quickly became known among the middle and lower classes as the rich man's war and the poor man's fight. Soon after this legislation passed, rioting spread angrily through New York City in a violent expression of displeasure with the law. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you of the past.
Also on March 3rd, 1871, the Senate decides it will no longer contract treaties with Native American nations. Congress calls all Native Americans wards of the state and nullifies all standing treaties. Also on March 3rd, 1873, Comstock Act makes it illegal to send obscene or lewd books or birth control information through the U.S. mail. Also on this date in 1919, a ruling on the conviction of anarchists Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, the Supreme Court upholds the Espionage Act. Goldman and Berkman were arrested during World War I for a so-called conspiracy against the draft. Today's court ruling thus puts draft resistance outside First Amendment protection. Emma Goldman's last act before entering prison is to organize a political prisoners' amnesty league. During the war, thousands of deserters have been sentenced to long prison terms. At Eagle Island, a concentration camp for deserters, many of them were systematically tortured. At the federal prison in Leavenworth, Kansas, prisoners have been hung by their wrists for up to weeks at a time. Take that, you peace-loving Quakers. Also on March 3rd, 1961, Village Council in Inuit town of Point Hope in a far northwestern Alaska objects by letter to President John F. Kennedy to a chain explosion of 5 atomic bombs in nearby above-ground Project Chariot test, to no avail. Also on this date in 1983, Acting President Ronald Reagan calls for a week of reporting only good news. Also on this date in 1989, Rodney King is savagely beaten by L.A. cops on this date, and it is all videotaped. Despite the video evidence, a nearly all-white jury will not convict the cops.
Seems so definitive. Why did the jury see the beating of Rodney King in such a vastly different light? Here's ABC's Judy Muller.
It was never even close. On the very first day of deliberations, a straw vote made it clear that a majority of the jurors favored acquittal. How could that be, given the powerful evidence of the videotape? Two jurors talked to ABC News today by phone.
These officers have a job to do, and in doing that job, they have to be given a certain amount of reasonable, and that's what this is, you know, reasonable force.
Several jurors say they were persuaded by the defense argument that the videotape did not tell the whole story and that Rodney King represented a threat to the officers. The jurors were convinced that it was King who controlled the action, that he could have stopped the beating by surrendering. The officers, they felt, used reasonable force.
The jury was made up of 10 whites, one Hispanic, and one Asian. Critics of the verdict are questioning whether this jury of their peers gave the white defendants an edge and whether King's race was a factor.
What human being wouldn't be influenced by this? You know, this is ridiculous. This is chaos right now, and I can't help but feel somewhat responsible.
And yet, he says, if he had to do it again, he would vote the same way.
And justice for all. This week in radical history, for March 4th, 1912, in England, suffragettes walk in single file in King Bridge, London, smashing every window they pass to protest government inaction. This week in radical history, for March 5th, 1917, Wobblies, Industrial Workers of the World, also known as IWW, go on trial in Everett, Washington. The labor agitators were gunned down by government-sanctioned mob, sheriff-led vigilantes. Like most cases of labor strife, the government, big business, police, military, and media are aligned against the unionists. Also on March 5th, 1983, can't see the forest from the trees. Acting President Ronald Reagan visits Klamath County, Oregon. Reagan says, quote,
"Well, there is today in the U.S. as much forest as there was when Washington was at Valley Forge."
A lie, of course. Actually, there is less than one-third. This week in radical history, from March 6, 1930, 100,000 demonstrate for jobs in New York City. Demonstrations by unemployed workers demanding unemployment insurance occur in a variety of major cities throughout the country. Police attack a crowd of 35,000 in New York City, and 10,000 people engage in melee with police in Cleveland. While 35,000 jobless workers march down Woodward in national protest against unemployment and hunger. Thousands join together and walk to the Ford Motor Company's employment office in Dearborn. Henry Ford, whose plant had laid off more than one-third of its employees, declared that, quote, "who wanted a job could find one," unquote. The marchers attend to take old Henry up on a statement. Violence erupts between the unemployed and police who join Ford's security forces. Shots are fired into the crowd, killing four protesters. Republican Congressman Hamilton Fish, with the support of the American Federation of Labor, AFL, also introduces a measure to Congress to create a committee to investigate radical activities. This would become the House Un-American Activities Committee. Have you driven a Ford out of town lately? Also on March 6, 1965, civil rights demonstrations begin a march from Selma to Montgomery to protest the murder of Jamie Lee Jackson and to demand voting rights for blacks. They are brutally beaten by police officers while crossing the bridge in Selma. 67 are injured. The attack become known as Bloody Sunday. Lastly, on March 6, 1974, the Weatherman Underground bombed the Department of Health in San Francisco to protest forced sterilization of poor women. This week in radical history, from March 7th, John Fry's Rebellion, also known as the House Tax Rebellion, an armed tax revolt led by a Pennsylvania farmer, began in 1799 and ran through 1800. It would be suppressed by the government, and Fry's and two others sentenced to hang, later pardoned by the president. Also on March 7th, 1921, Trotsky orders the artillery bombing of Kronstadt, entrenching the Bolshevik power and stopping any real chance of real reform in Russia. Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, feeling that their last tie to the Bolsheviks had been broken, decide to leave Russia and alert the world to what they have witnessed. Two more items for March 7th, 1942. IWW founder, anarchist labor organizer, Lucy Parsons, dies. She's described by Chicago Police Department once as more dangerous than 1,000 rioters. Lucy Parsons. Also in 1998, anarchist Jack Frager dies in New York. He is last arrested at age 88 during the Hiroshima Day protest for painting shadows of bomb victims on sidewalks in New York City. This week in Radical History for March 8, 1906. In the Philippines, U.S. occupations massacre an unruly band, mowing stubborn tribes people down with a combination of artillery fire and infantry assault. Men, women, and children are all slaughtered. Afterwards, President Roosevelt congratulates these brave Americans for, quote, a brilliant feat of arms within you, which upholds the honor of the American flag. Also on March 8, 1917, Cuba, U.S. invades Cuba for the fourth time. Also on this date in 1964, the first invasion of Alcatraz by Dakota Sioux, who claimed the island under the 1868 Sioux Treaty to remind America of the offer of government of $6.54 for the land, based on 49 cents per square acre, which is being considered proposed to be given for compensation for tribal Indian land stolen from California indigenous peoples. Yep, $6.54 for Alcatraz Island. Lastly, for March 8, 1971, 1,000 documents are stolen from the FBI office in Pennsylvania, later distributed in newspapers. Members of the Citizen Committee to Investigate the FBI, an arm of the Weathermen Underground, break into FBI offices revealing the existence of FBI's criminal COINTELPRO program, harassing domestic political dissidents. Here's a short segment about that from the documentary about the Weather Underground and COINTELPRO.
So there was a lot of outlaw culture. Because of the way that this country is falling apart, more and more young people are living in communal situations. More and more young people are beginning to fight the government on various levels. And so there's a huge mass of people that people who are underground fugitives can move amongst and have protection from and be with.
The weathermen were extremely bright. Many of them had access to fairly substantial amounts of money, which is the key to staying underground. We didn't get them, but we came close. It was frustrating when you wanted to catch these people as much as we did. You weren't going to catch these people in the standard FBI approach of surveilling the house the night before grandma's 50th wedding anniversary. So the fugitive comes walking in with a gift. Bang, you got him. It wasn't going to work that way. The way that we decided to do was to basically go underground, and essentially the same way they did, and use some investigative techniques which were very tried and true in the National Security Division.
They did break into people's apartments and steal things, did try to plant divisive stories among people who were working in the peace movement and the anti-war movement. And I had a whole strategy that included beating people up and dangling people out of windows. And, you know, it was not just light.
I know people who have liberal political tendencies would say it's terrible. People who don't would say that, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, nothing wrong is going to happen, nothing bad is going to happen to you.
In the early 1970s, a group of radicals calling itself the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI broke into an FBI field office in Media, Pennsylvania, and made off with several boxes of files. The documents, which were leaked anonymously to the press, revealed the existence of COINTELPRO, a secret FBI program to destroy a wide range of groups that opposed the U.S. government. The Black Panthers, the anti-war movement, even Martin Luther King. By the early 1970s, COINTELPRO had been largely effective.
The movement began to devour itself. There was the absence of all the things that made the movement so powerful. Absence of trust, absence of love, absence of a sense of humor, absence of commitment, absence of this communal, we're all in this together. All that stuff seemed to have been blown apart.
Don't let this happen to you.
Mother Earth says, now take good care of me. Please do not hurt me. Hey-o. Hey-o, hey-o, hey-o. And Father Sky says, now take good of me. Please do not hurt me. Hey, hey, oh. Hey, oh. ourselves, to be with one another, to be with our surroundings, to be, and we are here to take care of ourselves.
This has been This Week in Radical History, produced at the Mobile Fortress of Glee Glee Studios. Inspiration for this segment came from the Slingshot Organizer. Most of the radical info for the show came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. Some audio for this week's show was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York, and any music was from the Great Weekly Indigenous Voices program produced at Wolf Mountain Radio. Thanks for tuning in this week's show, and as always, and forever, I'm yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. Cries for intersectionality are at the center of organizing efforts for a host of social movements, the intersection of various liberation movements in solidarity against common oppressors. The movements for black liberation and the movement for Palestinian liberation are front and center in this organizing effort. There is a long history of these two movements lying together, going all the way back to the civil rights era, when SNCC publicly identified with the Palestinian Liberation Movement and subsequently lost almost all financial support from the Jewish community. I want to read a report written by Rod Such, former editor for World Book and Encarta Encyclopedias, who rehearses the history of these movements and analyzes their relationship today. I'm now reading from Rod Such's article found in the Electronic Intifada. Quote, when CNN fired black commentator Mark Lamont Hill in 2018 for a speech he gave at the United Nations International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, it recalled for some the forced resignation in 1979 of Andrew Young, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. The first African-American to hold that post, Young was fired simply for meeting with a representative of the Palestine Liberation Organization. The Andrew Young Affair, as it came to be called, is in many ways the centerpiece of Michael R. Fishbach's book, Black Power and Palestine, a meticulously researched history of the ties between the black and Palestinian liberation struggles from the 1960s to the 1980s. A professor of history at Randolph-Macon College Fishback explores how the Black Power movement of the 1960s embraced the Palestinian cause and how this eventually influenced moderate civil rights organizations that had unquestionably supported Israel. Fishback's historical overview charts how support for the Palestinians changed within a relatively short time from something expressed solely by radicals to something that became embedded with the mainstream black politics. The book goes beyond this, however, into the role of color and identity to explain why black Americans came to view the Palestinian struggle and their own as part of a global battle against colonialism and white supremacy. As early as 1903, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote in The Souls of Black Folk that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, making the issue of racism and white supremacy central to a historical period while also giving it a global dimension. By 1967, civil rights activist Jack O'Dell, an early advisor to Martin Luther King Jr., elaborated on this position in his magazine Freedom Ways when he wrote that black Americans represented a colonized people like their counterparts in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and that the bonds of color united them. Fishback provides a sweeping survey of the black power groups that took an internationalist perspective beyond civil rights advocacy, including the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, the Black Panther Party, and key intellectual and cultural figures. Malcolm X and SNCC were among the first to identify with the Palestinian struggle. As SNCC announced its opposition to the Vietnam War and support for the anti-colonial liberation struggles in Africa, an article in its June-July 1967 newsletter raised questions about Israel and Zionism. The article sparked a backlash, resulting in significant loss of donor support. Fishback cites multiple sources to a document that the backlash eventually undercut SNCC's ability to raise money and contributed to the organization's demise. The newsletter and subsequent articles isolated SNCC from mainstream civil rights organizations that had already admonished King for his Riverside Cathedral speech opposing the Vietnam War and for describing the U.S. government as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. Leading the charge against SNCC was civil rights activist Bayard Rustin, a key figure in organizing the 1963 March on Washington. Rustin helped deepen the split between black power and civil rights groups, culminating in full-page ads in June of 1970 in the New York Times and the Washington Post. The ads titled, "An Appeal by Black Americans for United States Support for Israel," ended with a plea to provide Israel and U.S. military aircraft, despite the avowed pacifism and nonviolent advocacy of many of the signatories, including Rustin. The black mainstream was fighting back vigorously against black power and its pro-Palestinian internationalism, Fishback writes. The battle for black identity had been joined. Here, however, is where the first cleavage in the civil rights movement began. Fishback details the furious reaction to the ad by the staff of the mainstream American Committee on Africa, ACOA, was not a black power organization. Indeed, some of the signers of the ad were on its board. ACOA, however, was a firm supporter of the anti-colonial struggles in Africa, particularly against apartheid South Africa. The staff was angry and the ad ignored the Israeli-South African alliance, along with Israel's sanctions against the Arab peoples of the Middle East. This narrative leads to the Andrew Young affair. At the time when Young was appointed UN ambassador, U.S. policymakers had agreed to an Israeli demand to have no diplomatic contact with the Palestine Liberation Organization. Ironically, Young violated the policy only because he was charged with heading off a PLO initiative to seek U.N. recognition for a Palestinian state. Civil rights groups were already angry that Young had been forced to resign. They became irate when they learned that Milton Wolf, the U.S. ambassador to Austria, had met on three occasions with the PLO several months prior to Young's forced resignation. The double standard on the treatment of a black diplomat and a Jewish diplomat disquieted mainstream civil rights groups, such as the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, founded by Martin Luther King Jr. and others. These groups differed from black power activists in that they believed their identity was American, not third world. Fishback writes, yet precisely because of that, they keenly resented what they saw as their marginalization from the realm of foreign policy. What followed was dramatic upturn in the willingness of mainstream black leaders to meet with PLO leader Yasser Arafat, including 1979 visits by Jesse Jackson and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference's Joseph Lowry. Yet it's belief that the Palestinians were fellow people of color that deserved their support remained. Black Power in Palestine is essential reading for those interested in these themes and the period in which they first emerge. Fishbach's insightful epilogue also makes it clear that struggle is ongoing. He cites the 2015 Black Solidarity Statement with Palestine, organized by the national network Black for Palestine, and the pushback it received. Indeed, these matters still reverberate today with the firing of Mark Lamont Hill and the denial of Human Rights Award to Angela Davis. The color divide prophesied in the 20th century by W.E.B. Du Bois and Malcolm X seems as relevant as ever, Fishback concludes. 5 decades after Black Power first championed the Palestinian cause. Unquote. That was an article written by Rod Such and originally published by the Electronic Intifada. Okay, moving on. Our feature presentation today is a talk given by Palestinian comedian and author Amer Zahr in the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. Amer Zahr has made quite a name for himself as a comedian who performs literally all over the planet. He's well known on U.S. campuses, but also has performed in major theaters throughout the country, including the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. In this presentation, he also reads from his book, Being Palestinian Makes Me Smile. Here is Palestinian comedian Amer Zahr.
Thanks, Zaina. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Thanks to the internet virtual world out there, if anyone's watching. Is anybody watching? Do we have any idea? Okay, good. I think my dad's watching because he's in Jordan, and I asked him to watch, and so he's staying up. Thank you for that introduction. I do dabble in all of those things that Zaina mentioned. However, my mom still tells people that I'm a lawyer, which is that I'm not a lawyer at all, so in case anyone's wondering. But, you know, why comedy? Why Palestinian comedy? I get asked this question a lot. What is a Palestinian doing comedy? What is there to laugh about? And I always say that we Palestinians could be very sad if we wanted to. It's very easy. If you're a Palestinian and you wanted to find reasons to be sad, it's not very difficult. You can watch the news every half an hour or so and probably find a story that could make you sad as a Palestinian. In fact, we don't even have, aside from not having a country, which is, you know, bad enough, we don't have holidays And we have a lot of commemorations. We have May 15th, which is they stole our land in 1948. We have June 5th, which is they stole our land in 1967. We have Yom al-Ard, which is they stole our land in 1976. We have a lot of they stole our land commemorations. We don't have any holidays, really. Christmas is maybe the one Palestinian holiday, but they're even trying to take that away from us. You know, if you talk to a lot of people in America, they think that Jesus had blonde hair and blue eyes and that he was from South Carolina. He's actually – are there any Palestinian men here today? Yes? Everybody look at that man over there. Okay? All right, that's what Jesus looked like, in case you're wondering. Jesus looked like that, okay? He didn't look like Brad Pitt. He looked like that. Not that you don't look like Brad Pitt, sir. You're a very handsome man. So these are the things that we have to deal with, right? I mean, it's very easy to be sad if you're a Palestinian. I just got back from a couple weeks in Palestine, and, you know, it doesn't take a long time before you can be sad. But I've learned over time two things. Number one, if you can make people – we Palestinians, we love telling stories, and we love telling people about our problems. And if you can make people laugh, they listen to you. I've learned this over time. You can only tell so many stories about, like, you know, in 1948 or, you know, until people don't – they stop listening. Laughter, though, gets people to listen to you. You might notice this at a business meeting where a guy wants to start a boring 3-hour presentation with a joke. Sometimes he's successful, sometimes he's not. But the idea is to get people kind of relaxed. And when you make people laugh, they listen to you. And Palestinians, if we need nothing else, we need people to listen to us. But I've also learned, actually, that laughter and sadness, or laughing and crying, are not that different. We've all seen somebody laugh so much that he starts crying. But sometimes you might even see somebody cry so much that he starts laughing. They're not that different. They come from the same place. You might cry at the ridiculous, and we Palestinians laugh at the ridiculous. I mean, people ask me what it's like to be a Palestinian, and I just tell them it's living in a completely alternate universe where things happen there that don't happen anywhere else in the world, and where normal things don't happen to you. I just came back from 10 days in Ramallah, and while I was there, I realized a lot of things. I mean, you know, I go to Palestine 2 or 3 times a year. Weird things happen there. You get introduced to people in a way that you would not get introduced to anyone else anywhere in the world. I was in Jerusalem last week, and one of my friends introduced me to somebody, said, this is my friend Ahmed. He is great. He is amazing. He is the best man I have ever met in my life. He was in jail 5 years. This, I don't think this happens anywhere else in the world. And as I was sitting in Ramallah, you know, somebody asked me, we were in a restaurant, and I had to get back to the hotel, so I wanted to figure out how to get there, and so I did what any good American would do. I took out my iPhone, and I got on Google Maps. Now, something you quickly realize is that there are no street names in Ramallah, at least nothing that is recognized by the world, not by Google, for sure. And I don't know if I really want them to recognize the street names in Ramallah. I don't know if anybody's ever been to Ramallah, but they're all named after, like, you know, there's Abu Jihad Lane over here and Che Guevara Boulevard over here, and it's a fairy tale. But in any case, I got on my phone, and I realized very quickly that there is no way. You can't even tell it where you're going because there's no, you know, you can't, there's no, you know, there's nothing. And I realized that that means that you can't order something. If you want to know what it's like to live in an alternate universe as Americans, imagine being in a place where you cannot order something off of eBay or Amazon and have it delivered to you. I mean, it's the only place in the world. Kenya, I think you can get something delivered. I mean, I'm nothing against people of Kenya, but I'm just saying. It's the only place in the world where you cannot just get online and tell them, please send us something here. It's just a completely alternate universe. And I remember driving around the United States government, for all the problems that we have with them, does do a lot of projects in the West Bank. Now, I think this is mostly like, guilt maybe or whatever it is. But there's a lot of projects being put on by USAID in the West Bank. And I was in Jericho. And they were building a new street or a new community center. I forget exactly. And they have these signs that say this project is a gift from the – has anybody seen these before? This project is a gift from the American people to the Palestinian people. And I'd heard about those signs, but I'd never been that up and close and personal with one of those signs. And I looked at it and I thought to myself, well, I'm in the West Bank, which is run by the Israeli military, which is fully funded by the United States government. There's a settlement right over there, which was built by the United States government. I said, isn't everything here a gift from the American people to the Palestinian people? It's an alternate universe. It's a weird place to be, but a wonderful place to be. I always tell people that I do not visit Palestine. I return to Palestine. There is no such thing as a visit for a Palestinian. We return there. And so my last return was very nice. But I missed America. I'm still an American. I missed free refills and dollar menus, and there's none of that. But it is a wonderful place. I wrote this, I don't want to say I wrote, it kind of sounds more important than it is, but I write a blog called The Civil Arab, and I a lot of times I write about being Palestinian. And really, my blog is something might happen, I'm not very good with the timing of it, I'm not very good with doing it every week, but when something happens, I write. And about half of them, I would say, have to do directly with Palestine or being Palestinian. And so I compiled them about over a span of 5 years into this book called Being Palestinian Makes Me Smile, which is also the name of the comedy show that's happening Friday night at the Kennedy Center. So I want to read a couple of these things, because while they are, they were written and meant to be read, but they're fun when I perform them too. I'm going to read a few of them and kind of give you a little story what happened, why I wrote one of them. I was at anyone here familiar with the Ramallah Federation of America? It's basically a family club, and they have conventions every year, people who are the original families of Ramallah. And I perform at their conventions. And so I was there a couple years ago, actually almost 4 years ago, in July of 2011. And something happened, and I felt compelled to write. This is a entry in my book called Beware, Being Palestinian is Contagious. Last weekend, I was lucky enough to perform at the annual convention of the American Federation of Ramallah Palestine in Washington, D.C. I saw many old friends and met many new ones. I performed in 3 comedy shows, and I can tell you this, Palestinians know how to laugh, especially at themselves. But I also confirmed something else I always suspected to be true. Being Palestinian is contagious. I met a few couples at the gathering that were, for a lack of a better word, mixed. Palestinians are spread all over the world. Being Palestinian basically means you can live anywhere except Palestine. As a result, we have more mixed marriages than any other species on earth. In America alone, we have occupied over 5 million non-Palestinians. Okay, I don't know if that number is exactly accurate, but it happens a lot. I met one particular white guy, let's call him Mark, his name really is Mark, who married a Palestinian woman. During one of my shows, I asked his father-in-law how he could let such a thing happen. It turns out his daughter was 33 when she married Mark, so that explains a lot. When single Arab women pass the age of 25, their parents tend to stop being too particular. When I asked Mark where his wife was, I noticed he was surrounded by Arab men on either side. As he identified his wife seated two chairs away from him, I discovered that this brother-in-law was sitting between him and his wife. I'm sure his brother-in-law was present on their first date, so I guess old habits die hard. In my comedy travels, I frequently meet white guys married to Palestinian women. And what I've noticed is that they have been Palestinianized. They love hummus, speak loudly, and march in demonstrations. They eat grape leaves, wear keffiyehs, and can recite UN Resolutions 194 and 242. They give their kids Arabic names, love garlic, and have pictures of Jerusalem in their homes. We have infected them. In a good way. Being Palestinian is cool. We Palestinians love it, so it's no wonder we rub off on others so easily. Incidentally, I have never seen the opposite happen. I've never witnessed a Palestinian marry a white American only to start suddenly saying, dude, liking Sarah Palin, or overindulging in mayonnaise. I have rubbed off on many people over the years. I've had a few white girlfriends, and if they didn't know about Palestine before they dated me, they sure did after. It has caused some uncomfortable moments. I remember when Brittany and Ashley both showed up to that anti-Israeli demonstration a few years ago. It was awkward. Being Palestinian is relentless. Every Palestinian has a story. Our stories and personal histories tell of our collective struggle. And once non-Palestinians have drunk the potion, there is no cure. No Palestinian can claim to be independent of our history. No Palestinian can escape it. To live a life divorced from political reality is impossible for us. We are consumed by history even before birth. Our greatest achievement is our abiding refusal to become casualties. When non-Palestinians join the club, they quickly realize that membership is not just a matter of eating too much garlic. It comes with an acute political memory unlike any other. I'm sure many white guys remember their first meeting with their prospective Palestinian father-in-law. After he served coffee and said hello, the next words out of his mouth were, "In 1948." After hearing that talk, you have caught the bug. But all in all, it's a pretty good bug to catch. The symptoms aren't all that bad. You will start overeating. White people can eat small meals and be satisfied. We eat meals in phases. We even take breaks. You will find yourself running to the dinner table and limping away from it. You will redefine the word cousin. For us, it can mean a first cousin, a third cousin five times removed, or even just a friend. It can also mean a wife. You will find that you start dancing in circular line formations at weddings and celebrations. You will stomp on the floor and sweat profusely. Relatives that you didn't know you had will grab your hand and lead you in the right direction. You will gain a whole new relationship with the Jewish people. You will find yourself criticizing their political viewpoints, praising their unity in defeating the Arabs, and randomly pointing them out whenever they appear on television. But you will also find yourself with a new warmth in your heart that never existed before, a warmth that exists for a homeland unrealized, a national potential waiting to be unleashed. You will realize that you start saying Palestine whenever possible. And if you have been truly and fully infected with the Palestinian bug, you will notice that whenever you hear the word, you will get butterflies in your stomach, just like the rest of us do. White Americans are not the only victims, however. On my last trip to Palestine, I noticed Israelis smoking hookahs and saying, "Yalla." Our aura is contagious. Israelis might try to pretend like we don't exist, but it's futile. We and our cultural awesomeness aren't going anywhere. Just ask Mark. You guys remember, I'm sitting in a room with a bunch of people who probably follow Palestine all the time, right? So this is like crack to me, all you people here. I don't need to explain anything. You guys remember a few years ago when Benjamin Netanyahu went to the UN and held up the bomb. Okay. This is called Bibi Entertains Us at the UN, September 2012. This week, Benjamin Netanyahu delivered a speech in front of the General Assembly of the United Nations. As a Palestinian, I tuned in. It's my duty. Plus, I say the guy's name at least 3 to 4 times a day. I won't tell you how or why, but the least I could do was listen to his speech. He started innocently enough, referring to how Israel is the ancestral homeland of the Jewish people, as well as their deep history and acumen. No problem. He called Jerusalem Israel's eternal capital. Whatever. He said the Jewish people will never be uprooted again. Fine. We restored our independence, he said. Okay. Well, Israel wanting to restore its independence from 3,000 years ago is kind of like me saying I'd like to restore my girlfriend from college. It might sound nice, but she already married somebody else. But I always knew that Benjamin Netanyahu was a proud Israeli who used history to make political points, so there was nothing surprising here. Then Bibi began to describe the current war between the modern and the medieval. He told us that modernity seeks a bright future in which the rights of all are protected, while medievalism, that's us, seeks to suppress knowledge and glorify death. He spoke of Israeli inventions and praised Israeli innovation. I will note, as my dad constantly reminded me, that the medieval Islamic world did invent algebra, chemistry, universities, chess, shampoo, surgery, numbers, and coffee. Yes, Starbucks is entirely our fault. And we invented flying carpets too, so take that. Of course, according to him, the war between modernity and medievalism is most stark in the Middle East. And Israel is, of course, on the side of modernity. Translations, Jews good, Arabs, Muslims bad. I always knew Bibi didn't like Arabs and Muslims. It's actually a job requirement for any Israeli prime minister. So there was nothing shocking here. Netanyahu then delved into the Palestinian-Israeli peace process. In order to solve the conflict, he told us all parties should avoid libelous speeches and unilateral declarations. But he has repeatedly called us a demographic threat. That's pretty defamatory. And Israel unilaterally pulled out of Gaza and blockaded it. It unilaterally built more settlements and unilaterally united Jerusalem. It even unilaterally declared hummus the Israeli national snack. I don't remember any negotiations about that. He also said, quote, we have to sit together, negotiate together, and reach a mutual compromise in which a demilitarized Palestinian state recognizes the one and only Jewish state. It kind of sounds like he's already decided the outcome of the mutual compromise. And I always wondered, why does he say it's the one and only Jewish state? Is anyone else making a claim? But I always knew Bibi held monumental double standards when it came to Palestinians and Israelis, so none of that stuff startled me. But he couldn't stop talking about those backwards Muslims. He told us that the medieval forces of radical Islam want to end the modern world, namely Israel, Europe, and America. Perhaps he doesn't know that those Arabs and Muslims hold a party whenever they get a visa to the United States and Europe. And if they get a green card, they set off fireworks. Maybe he thinks they're just having one last big strategy session before they set sail, getting one final lesson on explosives. He compared radical Islam to the Nazis. Now, that's just unfair. Muslims don't have any kind of universal hand gestures unless you count that circular hand motion they make when they're fighting about who should go through the door first. Then he started talking about nuclear weapons and Iran. Quote, to understand what the world would be like with a nuclear-armed Iran, just imagine the world with a nuclear-armed Al-Qaeda. Really, Al-Qaeda, we're supposed to believe the group that conducts military exercises on a playground could build a nuclear weapon? They can't even run a good boot camp. And let's be real, Al-Qaeda is not doing that well. Every week CNN tells me, today, a military strike killed Al-Qaeda's number two man. There's really no job security in that organization. He spoke of how close Iran is to making a nuclear bomb and how the world must ask now to stop them. Then he claimed to know how close Iran is to achieving its goal of world destruction. Then Bibi said, I brought a diagram. Now this was different. Israelis are not known for diagrams. They usually hate maps and annoying things like borders. This was totally new for me. I started to get interested. Now I always thought Netanyahu was a little imbalanced, but I didn't think he was completely insane until he held up a Roadrunner-like drawing of a circle with a squiggly black line coming out of it and said, this is a bomb, and this is a fuse. But I have to call Bibi out on this lie as well. I'm an Arab, and I can tell you with some authority, that is not what a bomb looks like. Of course, Bibi actually knows exactly what a bomb looks like, and he knows what a nuclear bomb looks like, too. It is estimated that Israel could have up to 400 nuclear bombs in its arsenal. But the only democracy in the Middle East has a policy of opacity when it comes to its nuclear program. In other words, no one gets to know anything about Israel's nuclear program, but everyone has to know everything about Iran's. Israel has refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And in case anyone was wondering, every state in the modern world has signed it. In fact, almost every medieval Islamic nation has signed it too. I have an important piece of paper I'd like to show the Prime Minister of Israel, and there's something I need to tell him about it. This is a treaty, and this is where you sign it. Yes, just about 2 years ago. You'll know this for sure if you're Palestinian, and you probably will know it even if you're not. But there was a Palestinian drafted into the NFL. Anybody remember this? We Palestinians were very excited that day. This is called There's a Palestinian in the NFL. Palestinians are split. Palestinian Americans are split on a fundamental American issue, football. Many from my father's generation of immigrants are simply confused by the whole concept. They came from a land and time where football meant kicking a ball with your foot into a goal. Trying to divorce them from this word association is extremely difficult. The children of these immigrants, like me, who grew up in this country, see football as the beautiful American tradition that it is. I have tried to explain to my father that a touchdown is basically a goal, and that each team is trying to get more touchdowns than the other. I told him it is soccer with helmets, or football with helmets, if to you football actually means soccer. But football is also a violent sport with fierce impacts, armor, and screaming. It brings men together in a passionate, non-sexual way. And it includes barely dressed women on the sidelines jumping up and down, and sometimes even climbing on top of each other. Once my father learned these things, he became interested. Odey Abushi is a Palestinian-American. A few months ago, he was drafted by the New York Jets to play professional football. I'm sure this was a dream come true for him. Of course, we Palestinians all immediately heard the news. We have a secret email list. We were proud. Most of us didn't know him, but we were proud. Then last week, Yahoo Sports published an article by Adam Waxman accusing Odey of anti-Semitic activism. At just about the same time, an employee of Major League Baseball, Jonathan Mayo, tweeted, "The New York Jets are a disgrace of an organization. The Patriots have Aaron Hernandez, who had just been accused of murder. The Jets have Odey Abushi." Of course, Aaron Hernandez is a star NFL tight end who has recently been arrested for murder. Odey is just a Palestinian. Adjacent to Ramallah lies the city of Elbiri. Thousands of Elbiri's descendants live in America. A couple weeks ago, they held a convention in a hotel outside of Washington, D.C. It was basically a big family reunion. And I really mean that. When cousins start marrying each other, family reunions need to be held in a hotel. A big hotel. But on the bright side, Ancestry.com loves Palestinian customers. Coming up with their report takes about 5 minutes. "Dear customer, your father is your mother's cousin. Your grandfathers are brothers, which also means they are each your great uncle. Your father is your father, but he is also your first cousin removed. Same goes for your mother. Your brothers and sisters are also each your second cousin, and you are also, in fact, your own cousin. Enjoy the rest of your day." Odey Abushi attended this convention as an invited guest. Waxman used his attendance as evidence of Odey's anti-Semitism. Odey was not quoted, and none of his actions were detailed. He was just a guest at a big family reunion. See, to supporters of Israel like Mayo and Waxman, and to many Jews, unfortunately, Palestinians are by default anti-Semitic. Believing us all as anti-Semitic is simply inaccurate. I can easily prove that I'm not an anti-Semite. I love bagels, cheesecake, and Seinfeld. And Jews invented the weekend. So these are my kind of people. But using the anti-Semitic label so freely also does something else. It kills the conversation. Once someone is called a vicious racism, his opinion is less worthy. And so is his existence. And for Palestinians, we cannot end the conversation. We need to tell our story. So maybe those calling us anti-Semitic know exactly what they're doing. Now, I wouldn't mind being labeled if only we're done accurately. Palestinian Americans are some of the most successful and most educated citizens living in this country. We always do extremely well in whatever path we choose. Now, that might be because we don't have a country to go back to, but whatever. So none of us were surprised that Odey made it all the way to the NFL. We expect excellence. Plus, for his own sake, he had to succeed. I don't even want to imagine what his mom would have done if he didn't get drafted. Being Palestinian follows us wherever we go and whatever we do. O'Day is now in the limelight. He will be seen as suspect. Fans will hold up signs. His existence will be highly politicized. Everything he does, good or bad, will have a lot of gravity to it. For every person praising him, there will be at least one other expressing outrage. He is a Palestinian. And so he will be seen as some sort of threat to the working order of things. And whether he likes it or not, his entry into the NFL will mean more than maybe it should. He is not a football player. He is a Palestinian football player. And being Palestinian is unyielding. There are no breaks. And just when it looks like everything's okay, someone calls us barbaric, resentful, hateful, or invented. Our relatives who live in Palestine have to deal with daily killing and humiliation. Those of us who live everywhere else have to explain it. Basically, Palestinians spend most of our time trying to explain to everyone that we are, in fact, human beings. But don't feel bad for us. When we meet each other, we get excited. We share stories. We laugh and cry at the same things. When we say goodbye, we can't wait to see each other again. We have a connection to one another that no one else could ever understand. And so, O'Day, when you were drafted, we were all drafted. And while my dad might not really understand football, he understands that. Okay, I'll read one more, and then we'll get into a discussion or questions. Last year, you know, a little less than a year ago, when the Israelis were bombarding Gaza, I was watching the news, as I do, you know. For those of you who don't know, Arabs, watching the news is like a social activity for us. We make popcorn, and we call our friends, and we watch the news. Because we're on it all the time. It's like a reality show for us. And so, I just got done making a documentary called We're Not White, because, as you know, Arabs are technically classified as white by the United States government. And, you know, we're not white, although I wish we were, because it seems really awesome. And you know, they're not, you know, there are no white experts on TV. There are no, no one has to explain why their whiteness caused them to do, you know, whatever they did. So, you know, we're not white, but I wish we were. But anyway, we watch the news all the time. And I was watching news every day, as most Palestinians were during the war on Gaza last summer. And I was watching all the spokesmen come speaking for Israel. And so I wrote an article called The Accents of the Israeli Team, August 2014. For many, following all the ins and outs of the Israeli-Palestinian saga can be confusing. Hamas did that. The Israeli army did that. They started the war. No, they started the war. They broke the ceasefire. No, they broke the ceasefire. Hamas belongs to them. No, it belongs to them. It is all very overwhelming. One thing, however, is glaringly clear. American journalists seem to have a much easier time having conversations with Israeli officials than they do with their Palestinian counterparts. The reason is obvious. All of Israel's official mouthpieces speak perfect, unaccented English. And why wouldn't they? After all, they are not from Israel. Peter Lerner is the foreign press spokesperson for the Israel Defense Forces. He was born in London in 1973. He immigrated to Israel in 1985. Hebrew, one of the two official languages of Israel, yes, Arabic is an official language too, because Israel is a democracy. Hebrew is his second language. You might have wondered why Peter Lerner sounds more like a spokesperson for the Queen than he does for Israel. Why wouldn't he? He is, after all, a foreigner in the land of Israel. Dori Gold is a diplomat who has served in many Israeli governments. He was once Israel's ambassador to the United Nations. He is currently the president of an Israeli think tank in Jerusalem. He was born in Connecticut, attended high school in Massachusetts, and earned a BA, MA, and PhD from Columbia University in New York City. He has appeared on television numerous times during Israel's latest offensive, defending and explaining the policies of the Netanyahu government. As you might expect, his English is perfect. Mr. Gold lives in Jerusalem. He might even live in a house that once belonged to Palestinians. Of course, I don't know that for sure, but trust me, in Jerusalem, it's a safe bet. You might have wondered why Dori Gold sounds like a Yankees fan. Why wouldn't he? He is, after all, a foreigner in the land of Israel. Mark Regev is the official spokesman of the Netanyahu government. In 1960, he was born in Australia, where he grew up and finished college. He immigrated to Israel at the age of 22, where he began his graduate studies at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He has remained in his adopted homeland ever since. Hebrew is also his second language. You might have wondered why the official Israeli spokesman sounds more like Crocodile Dundee. Why wouldn't he? He is, after all, a foreigner in the land of Israel. Michael Oren was most recently Israel's ambassador to the United States. He was born in upstate New York. He earned his MA and PhD from Princeton University in New Jersey. He immigrated to Israel in his mid-20s. He has lectured at dozens of American campuses. He articulately defends Israeli policies on American televisions across our great country. Well, he is usually articulate, if you don't count his recent interview on MSNBC, when he suddenly, and quite conveniently, couldn't hear Andrea Mitchell when she asked him about reports that Israel had eavesdropped on John Kerry last year. But even when he flusters and fumbles, he speaks eloquent East Coast English. You might have wondered why Michael Oren sounds like an American university professor. Why wouldn't he? He is, after all, a foreigner in the land of Israel. Mickey Rosenfeld is the Israeli police spokesperson to the foreign press. He speaks English flawlessly. That's because he is English. Yep, he was born in England and grew up there. He is blonde and blue-eyed. There's nothing wrong with that, of course. He grew up with Duran Duran, the English Premier League, and bland, terrible food. The garlicky cuisine of his new homeland must have come as a bit of a shock to him. You might have wondered why Mickey Rosenfeld sounds like Piers Morgan. Why wouldn't he? He is, after all, a foreigner in the land of Israel. Ron Dermer is Israel's current ambassador to the United States of America. He has been all over CNN in recent weeks. He attended the University of Pennsylvania. Before moving to Israel in his 20s, he was born in 1971 in Miami Beach, where both his father and brother were once the mayor there. He is one of Netanyahu's closest advisors, writing many of his speeches in English, I assume. He is highly educated, yet for some reason, he still sounds obnoxious and rude during just about every interview. You might have wondered why Ron Dermer sounds like a whiny kid from Florida. Why wouldn't he? He is, after all, a foreigner in the land of Israel. Now, I don't really mind that all of these Israeli messengers speak perfect English in American, Australian, and British accents. However, I do mind that with all that Western education, they still can't pronounce Hamas. They insist on continuing to say Hamas. This is just offensive. Hamas is already frightening enough with its crappy rockets, ancient rifles, and hooded militants. Do they really need to have to add that chilling ha sound? Do they do that with all H sounds? It would make some nursery rhymes seem just downright scary. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. It just sounds alarming. Come on, guys. It's Hamas. Like, happy. Just think that. Hamas, happy. Hamas, happy. See, it works. In any case, this is the cast of characters acting as Israel's cheerleaders to the American public, justifying racial supremacy, ethnic cleansing, and indiscriminate bombing campaigns. Definitely sounds better when it's done in an accent we can all relate to. But I'm sure every American listening to them still wonders why all these Israelis sound like the next-door neighbor. Why wouldn't they? They are, after all, foreigners in the land of Israel. Foreign colonist settlers. Okay, thank you.
That was Palestinian comedian and author Amer Zahr in the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
to BCFM's Politics Show. Former Sunday Times journalist Kevin Carhill and me, Tony Gosling. The third set of bribery charges filed by the police against Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu, the Haaretz paper this week, leading on a demand for him, having now lost all credibility, according to them, to step down immediately. Instead, Bibi doubles down by hopping into bed with the extreme right Kahanis Party, Otzma Yehudit, or Jewish Power Party, who some say believe in a Zionist master race. And also, Home Secretary Saeed Javid is banning the political wing of Hezbollah, whose place now in the Lebanese government and parliament grew from the militias resisting the 2006 Israeli invasion of Lebanon. The Jewish Power, by the way, have been out of the Knesset for 30 years or so, but as a result could be back after next month's Israeli elections. Plus, from last week, Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro is a US rabbi, just one of many who have very different ideas about what we hear in the mass media and what the Jewish identity means, what the Israeli state and the Zionists are telling us. And his audience fills a US stadium. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon on Tuesday. Former microwave technology worker Mark Stevens from Gateshead takes a critical look at what the 5G networks could mean, hacking our homes and for our health this week. More also on the Magnitsky Act. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download the show from dialectradio.co.uk. But also to Venezuela. The BBC's bias on reporting events there has horrible echoes from Iraq, Libya and Syria, etc. Totally one-sided, with no mention of the US sanctions on Venezuela or the hundreds of millions in the Bank of England of Venezuelan money which the bank is withholding. So we hopefully find an expert on South America and the antics of the US and the NATO empire to ask what extent Venezuela's problems are of their own making and how much support within his country Maduro really has. And I hope I'm joined on the line now by Andre Vilcek. Andre, are you there?
Hi, Tony. Yes, I'm here.
Okay, fantastic. What about your take on what's been going on over the last few weeks in Venezuela? The first question really being, to what extent could we say that Maduro is a legitimate president or isn't he?
Tony, Maduro is totally legitimate president. He won elections again and again. He won recent elections with around 68%. And what you hear in England, actually, is from mass media, is a total propaganda. Look, there is no country in the world that would have so many referendums as Venezuela. They put everything through the plebiscites. Every little change of the constitution, every change of laws. They have constant elections, and more elections they have, more they are being accused by the West of being dictatorial. And that's actually the plan. That's precisely what the West is doing with all democratic governments in Latin America, except that Venezuela is the most democratic of them. And that's obviously what you don't hear from the mass media at all. You hear the opposite.
So what about the terrible problems that have been happening inside Venezuela? Why those?
Well, that I can explain to you very easily. This is precisely what is happening since the coup against President Allende in Chile in 1973, coup that was financed and triggered by the Chase Manhattan and ITT and, of course, Kissinger and the others like. Basically, you create a situation when so-called economy screams. You create deficits, you create all sorts of problems, and you which are great and totally pro-Western, and they would do absolutely anything to destroy their own country because they serve the West. They don't serve their own people. So that's how it's done. These people actually own businesses. They own distribution supermarkets, agricultural companies, the mass media, and they actually would rather lose in very actually uncapitalistic way, because they are feudals, they are not capitalists even. They would rather lose tens of millions of dollars than to lose power. So they start choking the economy, they start creating deficits of food, of consumer goods, of even of toilet paper. And then they say, you see, this is the problem of the left-wing government. And this is happening again and again and again, and people in the West don't seem to notice, or they don't want to notice it.
What about outside influences? Because we've just seen a change of government in Brazil, and the US has been extremely busy. I suppose it's AmeriCom, the Pentagon's branch which tries to manage South America, in next door Colombia too. But the most recent change is Brazil. What does that mean for Maduro?
Oh, I exactly spoke about this on RT yesterday. Brazil had to go off the way. The West basically triggered a constitutional coup against Dilma Rousseff. Then, again, with the Brazilian elites, they made sure that Lula da Silva, the most popular politician in Brazil from the Workers' Party, from the left, would end up in jail. So all this led to the constitutional coup in Brazil, election of the fascist president and the government, and basically, Brazil of the way, anything can now happen in Latin America. Because, they speak about the U.S. as a old cop that nobody elected, but Brazil was a good cop for Latin America. It's the most populous nation with around 200 million. It used to be socialist for more than a decade, and whenever there was some problem of tremendous importance, like when Santa Cruz province in Bolivia tried to secede, Brazil said that it will happen only over their dead body, and that they are going to send the troops and support democratically elected government in La Paz of Evo Morales. So the same thing would happen definitely if Lula would be now president of Brazil. There would be such a tremendous support from Maduro that nobody would dare to really even speak about the military action or military intervention against Venezuela. Of course, there is Mexico now, the biggest Spanish-speaking country in the world. And President Obrador was elected last year. He's a socialist. He's left-leaning a person. But as we all know, Mexico is right next to the United States. And Obrador has to be a chess player. He has to actually very carefully balance between not getting assassinated themselves and to support President Maduro and other left-wing leaders in Latin America.
What about the wider picture, though, in Latin America? Because it does seem as if the Pentagon does, and the US particularly, cast an enormous shadow over the southern half of the continent. To what extent do you think Trump is behind this? Or is this a sort of military-industrial complex Pentagon machine that churns away whoever the president is?
Yes, well, both. I think under Obama we were very often wondering if they forgot about Latin America because they were spreading terror in other parts of the world. But, they never forget the leaders or the entire machinery or the complex that creates this regime, that Western-sponsored global regime. They never forget. And Latin America went too far. From their point of view, there is, of course, Monroe Doctrine, and there is pragmatic interest in controlling the world. I mean, Venezuela is often mentioned as a country which is so rich in terms of oil and natural gas and other raw materials that they could supply oil for 30 years to the entire world. It's incredible what they found in the Orinoco Basin. But I always say that, yes, of course, this is one of the reasons, but it's not the only reason. Let's not forget that there is really fundamentalist ideological reason in the U.S. or U.K. Or in France. It's really the need and desire to control the whole world politically and ideologically. And that part is always kind of overlooked by the soft left. They always talk about oil, they talk about natural resources, but the fundamentalist factor and the fact of the way the West is brainwashed by really this desire to control, and by its belief that it's exceptional and democratic and all this, it should never be underestimated. Venezuela is a very dangerous country for those who feel like that, because it's a real Latin American ideological powerhouse. They believe in great motherland of Latin American countries. It's a left-wing government. So I'm sure that two factors here are playing such an important role, and they are trying to destroy Venezuela by all means. They tried it in a softer way in the past. There was already one U.S. coup directly, trying to imprison Hugo Chavez and bringing another just a clown to the top of the country, and now it's happening the second time. Look, the same thing happened to Syria, because Syria is a pan-Arabic nation. The same thing happened to Libya, because it was a pan-Africa, center of pan-Africanism. So they are really afraid of these things. It's basically probably the most important factor, maybe more important than oil.
Well, okay, so you talk about this Western-sponsored global regime. Well, they've got a little bit of a poke in the eye from the United Nations with vetoes on the US resolution by both Russia and China. Where is this Western-sponsored global regime you talk about, if it exists? Where is it actually based? Who is doing the thinking behind it, and what's the overall objective?
I don't see it as strictly American game. I think in UK you are greatly involved in it too. So is France. I mean, basically, it's a continuation of colonialism that Europe was spreading all over the world for 500 or more years. I mean, I always say, just look at the map of the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, there was not hardly any free country in the world. It was all plundered, massacred by genocidal European colonialism. So a country like UK, they are very much behind the propaganda. That's why British propaganda is so much effective and so much vicious than the American one. I mean, Americans are just doing the vulgar and dirty job most of the time, but the entire ideology of this Western regime comes from the places like UK or France. You know, I'm just now in LA. I'm working with a great left-wing American philosopher, John Cobb, on our next book, and I'm actually in his place. That's why the noises. And we are. I hardly come to the United States, or I try not to come, but at least once a year I come to show films or to speak and all that. And, you know, I read the LA Times, and it's disgusting, but so is New York Times. But it's not as disgusting as reading the British publications online. I mean, just opening The Guardian or web pages of The Guardian or the background material that you sent to me is just unbelievable. And it's shocking that people in UK are actually not rolling on the floor laughing or throwing up, because it's really beyond any. This is beyond anything that we experienced in the last decades. Even if you read, look, I grew up in communist Czechoslovakia, and I was born in Soviet Union. I'm used to what in the West lies they call massaging of the facts and even propaganda, but it's nothing. It was not the language that the UK mass media is using now is so much more vitriolic and so much much less objective than what we were getting even in the Eastern Europe.
Okay, so what have you taken objection to?
I just don't understand how can you leave the stomachs?
But what have you taken objection to? I sent you a couple of articles. One was about the, I think it's around about £1 billion of Venezuelan money that the Bank of England is sitting on, which could, of course, be being used to aid the country. Bank of England's Governor Mark Carney won't release. And it's also the suspension from the Labour Party this week of the Labour MP, Chris Williamson, over charges of anti-Semitism. Now, he was the person who was the main Labour Party spokesperson, really backing Maduro, saying, look, we don't want regime change in Venezuela, thank you.
I know. No, I'm talking about the first material you said about the Bank of England. I mean, it's not about the facts. It's about the language, how they describe the government of Venezuela, how they describe the problems, how they define the problems that Venezuela is facing. There is nothing about what we talked about 15 minutes ago, that how the crisis, so-called crisis, was triggered, how it was created. It's all basically blaming the government. It's government shooting the people, the protesters. I mean, who are these protesters? What is the aid? The entire Latin America knows what the aid is. The reason some countries like Argentina or Brazil or Colombia are actually supporting the Western narrative is because it's to their interest. But nobody has any doubts that there is no aid. It's basically just a way to break into Venezuela. This is how the weapons used to be smuggled into the countries where the West wants to trigger the coups. And it's also psychological war. I mean, to promote this Guaido boy, who nobody even knew about in Venezuela before he was elected by the U.S. and its European cohorts.
Well, how would you set the record straight then? I mean, we hear lots about things like economic warfare. I mean, you've talked about how some people in industry in Venezuela, I mean, owners of big companies, etc. I mean, many people will find it incredible, Andre, that they would actually destroy their own markets for some sort of political reason. In other words, that they would create shortages deliberately. That sounds like a crazy conspiracy theory.
They do, Tony, and it's not conspiracy. I mean, I know these people from Bolivia, I know these people from Venezuela. They go against even principles of capitalism. Look, you are talking about the feudal, rulers there, and most of them of different ethnic groups than the majority of the population. These people were in charge of these countries for five centuries. So for them to, and they are so filthy rich that for them to lose $10 million, $20 million is nothing. I know people in Bolivia who are, one family could have senator in the family, owner of the newspaper and owner of the supermarket chain, for example. So these are feudal clans, and it's no conspiracy. You can look at it into it clearly and see what happened in Chile in 1973. It's exactly replaying the same scenario. And you are familiar. Okay. I know you wrote a lot about and you spoke a lot about Chile. The same thing happened in Chile.
Yeah. We're just going to bring Kevin Cahill in now, former Sunday Times journalist. Kevin.
The Salvador Allende's IT advisor was my friend, Stafford Beer. So I remember the coup against Allende very well. But you're talking about the long term, the feudal nature of the oligarchs, and I think you're right. My specialization was land, and this rule by the oligarchs, and I think there are the oligarchs on all sides. Money is what defines them, capital. And the anti-democratic stuff in America is a bunch of oligarchs, the exact equivalent of the oligarchs in Russia. But I think your thesis is correct. It's feudal in mentality.
Andre, you worked for Telesur English, haven't you? I mean, this is, I think, quite an amazing thing to have come out of Latin America. Will they be able to survive, do you think? And will Telesur survive? Will you be able to still make documentaries there?
No, Tony, let's correct this. I made 5 documentary films for Telesur from all over the world, and it was not for the English section. I mean, I was working for Telesur. My documentaries were made in Spanish.
I mean, do you want to just say something about who Telesur are for people who've never come across it, although there is an English version?
There is an English version, yes. I mean, but I do not work with them because I don't feel that Telesur in English really reflects the position of the Venezuelan government. I mean, there is too much anarcho-syndicalism from the West and too many people who are actually who infiltrated it from the, you know, defunct Western left. So I don't. I used to write for them after I made documentary films, but I don't. I'm not writing for them.
No, but
too
it's been. What I'm trying to get to is it's been quite an important force, nevertheless, hasn't it?
Yes, Telesur in Espanol, the Telesur is extremely important force, yes. I'm talking about the Telesur in English, but Telesur in Spanish language, original Telesur, is extremely important force. What will happen to them? It's not only Venezuelan project, it's Pan-Latin American project, basically, hopefully going to survive, as I also hope that Venezuela is going to survive in the shape in which it is. If something happens to it, it's going to be a problem, for Telesur as well. But Telesur has producers, reporters from all over Latin America, so it's not only Venezuela.
What's your crystal ball then? Do you think Maduro will be able to tough this out in the face of psychological warfare, propaganda from the West, and also economic warfare?
I have no doubt that he will do his best, and I have no doubt that all of us who support the government will do our best. I'm writing a lot about this. I'm speaking to all television stations all over the world that are having me on Venezuela. But if Venezuela is going to be attacked, I have my luggage packed and I'm going. I mean, as I hope others would go to defend the revolution, because I think this is basically the hot spot. It's the most important place now where the battle for survival of the left is going to take place.
I mean, so, for people who've never been there, what sort of country is it?
It's a wonderful country with great culture. It's a very beautiful country, inhabited by very passionate people, as you can see, people who are very interested in everything from politics to arts, and they definitely have a great scale of different ideas, and these ideas, unlike in Europe, where everybody thinks that there is only one political system possible, in Venezuela, it's not the case. In Venezuela, there is a lot of different points of view. There is a lot of and people defend these points of view passionately. They fight for them, and so on and so on. It's just people like Guaido. People like Guaido, who is a handpicked puppet of the West. He has no passions or no idea, no political views. He's just basically repeating what he's asked to repeat.
Yeah, he's reading a script. This is what quite a lot of them do. You know, they don't speak from the heart. Anyway, look, while you're on, Andre, before you go, I just want to put something to you about Crimea, which came up in Prime Minister's... I hope you don't mind just hanging on a minute more, which came up in Prime Minister's questions in the House of Commons this week. So if you just have a listen to that, we'll just get a comment from you when that's finished.
John Whittingdale! It's my rightful friend aware that 5 years ago today, Russian special forces seized the government buildings in Crimea and raised the Russian flag. Will my rightful friend confirm that the UK government remains committed to the restoration of Ukrainian sovereignty over Crimea? And will she look at strengthening sanctions against Russia until that can be achieved?
I'm very happy to give that confirmation to... My right honourable friend, this was an illegal annexation of Crimea by Russia, and we have been doing everything in relation to sanctions that we can to ensure that the appropriate sanctions are imposed that will have an impact. We have been one of the voices around the EU Council table that has been advocating at every stage, not just the rollover of sanctions, but ensuring that as we look at the actions of Russia here and elsewhere, we enhance those sanctions and rightfully put pressure on those who are responsible.
Now that's Theresa May and John Whittingdale. Andre, fifth anniversary of the annexation of Crimea.
Oh, yes. Annexation of Crimea? I mean, basically Crimea coming home with some 90% of Russians living there and the population that voted democratically in referendum that they want to go home after the drunken stupor of Khrushchev in which he gave Crimea to Ukraine, which was still part of the Soviet Union, as was Russia. So, I mean, what is more democratic than people voting, the overwhelming majority voting on coming home to the country where they historically always belonged? So all this is a continuation of propaganda, and the people like Theresa May are so desperate because they know that they are going to lose ideological war with the rest of the world, and that their crimes against humanity are being exposed now by independent media, that they are just shouting nonsense basically blocking even their own ears from hearing what the rest of the world is saying.
We don't hear a lot, do we?
And censoring independent media, censoring RT, censoring other news outlets that are telling the truth.
Well, we've got, one of the things they never tell us about is the March 16th, 2014 referendum in Crimea, where the Crimean people voted 97% that they wanted to return to be part of the Russian Federation. Why is it that we don't hear that?
Well, this, you should ask this question to the censors of your media. I mean, ask The Guardian, because we are talking about it all the time. The RT, Telesur, Press TV, all the magazines and newspapers for which I write, we all talk about it all the time. The problem is they don't publish us.
What about Crimea? I mean, we had the Crimean War with Winston Churchill many, many years ago. And what is the strategic importance of it? Maybe we can just finish on that one, Andre.
Strategic importance is to smear Russia. I mean, here they had some they could say that while the West is invading everything and overthrowing anything on its way, Russia wants annex something what is its own, and what actually the population of the area there of Crimea voted overwhelmingly to join. So I mean, here they had at least some kind of a little bit of possibility to say, oh, Russia is invading as well. You see, so it's just a little propaganda trick, nothing else. I mean, there is really nothing. Strategically, it's important because it is controlling the water waves that are used by Ukraine, which European Union wants to lull into its ranks. And the result of all this, poor Ukrainian people. You know that Ukraine, after all this flirting with the West and after antagonizing Russia, while Russia is now one of the richest countries in the world again, despite the sanctions, Ukraine has the minimum income, which is lower than in Indonesia. It's absolutely miserable. It's like it's below the Southeast Asian countries in terms of the quality of life and incomes. So you see where it all leads.
Well, I noticed also Poroshenko is being impeached, the president, and it's about to be re-elected, but it doesn't look like he'll do very well.
I mean, Poroshenko is basically a criminal. I went to West Africa to investigate his dealings with Cocoa. He's called the Chocolate King, you know. I mean, it's... He's... driving like slaves of African people there on his cocoa plantations. I was almost murdered there. I was locked in my hotel when I was investigating, you know, in Abidjan. It's incredible what this person is doing. So what he's doing in Ukraine is just a reflection of what he's doing elsewhere, the Chocolate King.
Okay, Andre, where's a good place to keep up with what's happening in Venezuela and where to follow your work online?
Okay, you can just go to my website, but also just Google my name. My stuff is now all over in Global Research, on Global Research on 21st Century Wire, which is a British, news wire, news agency. Then, you know, plenty of publications. I publish in NEO, which is a magazine of Academy of Science of Russian Federation. It's published in English. But maybe like 30, 40 sites. So just Google my name and it's all there. Put it online because my name is unpronounceable.
VLTCHEK. Lovely.
Nobody will get it. Nobody will believe it.
Okay,
anyway,
so I'll put up links on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to all that. Andre Vilcek, thanks very much for joining us.
Tony, after LA, I'm going down to Latin America, so you can contact me anytime. I will be happy to be on your show again.
Are you going to Venezuela?
I'm not going this time. I'm going to Bolivia, and I'm going to Mexico to work with the governments that are supporting, actually, Venezuela.
Okay, so be lovely. Maybe you could check in again in a few weeks' time.
Definitely.
Andre Vilcek, thanks very much for joining us. Kevin, what do you make of what we've been hearing there?
Well, Crimea was grabbed by Russia in the early 1700s, pretty well the same time we grabbed Gibraltar. And the same thing, it was an imperial grab. But Crimea became Russian over the next 200 years. And the referendum you mentioned is, I think, the decisive factor. That's what the people of the area, under the UN rules, said they wanted. They wanted to be reunited with Russia. So this
97% is quite a big majority, isn't it? It's not like the Brexit vote.
No, there is no division. The Crimea had become, over the 200 years between 1700, it had become Russian. And I think the Second World War had a good deal to do with it as well. But it's just propaganda. You know, it's the same problem. The media in the West... Really, I mean, it sounds like we're being left. We're not. The media in the West is one-sided, incredibly one-sided. The idea of giving the public the facts and letting the public decide seems to have been lost.
So why is balance gone from so much of our London press? Why is that? Because balance is something, you know, we as journalists are taught to make. You've got to try and show both sides.
This is the key. Go back to the 2 weeks ago, the House of Commons Digital Committee produced its report on Facebook. And the chair had a lovely snappy phrase to describe Facebook. He described Facebook as a bunch of digital gangsters. So that caught the headlines. What nobody looked at was what was really in the report. If you look carefully, the report had set out to be a big splash about Russian interference in the referendum. There was Russian interference. It was negligible, but it was on the same side as the oligarchs in the United States putting their money in through Aaron Banks and people. The Russian interference wanted us out of the EU too. So, of course, nobody picked it up and you know, developed it. So there's one sample. I mean, how would the English public feel if all this razzmatazz about Russian interference turned out to be a con, which it is?
Why do you say that, then?
Because the issue is balance. The United States spends at minimum of $60 billion a year interfering in Russia, interfering in Russian elections, interfering in Russian social life, interfering in Russian politics.
Well, you know what? Since the Brexit vote, I've heard loads more US voices on the BBC all the time. We seem to be getting them on Radio 4, on the World Service. In fact, it was wonderful this week, and what I'll do is I'll see if I can get a recording of it and play it next week maybe, is where the guy from Chatham House was actually introduced by the BBC World Service presenter as a former CIA. And this is what we seem to be getting all the time. It's basically an intelligence people posing as independent experts.
Chatham House has literally become an extended arm of the CIA. They have no objectivity, and they have no respect for... Chatham House is meant to be an institution in our country. The only thing it does in relation to the British public is treated with contempt.
I seem to remember, maybe you can confirm this or deny it or whatever, but actually the Council on Foreign Relations and Chatham House and other institutes for international affairs around, particularly around Europe, they're in France, Germany, Czech Republic, were initially seed funded, the British and the American ones anyway, through Cecil Rhodes's will. Because he wanted, he was around at the time, at the late 19th century. He basically took over Africa. He was exploiting Africa for its mineral resources and making a fortune. And as the British Empire was expanding in the late 19th century, early 20th century, Cecil Rhodes thought, well, if we carry on like this, we could take over the world. Mm. And so in his will, he put his money towards setting up what he called, in the early wills, he took it out of the later wills, a secret society that the British could use to take over the world. The British Empire would just simply grow and grow. Now, that that's certainly my reading of what Chatham House is it grew out of that. The idea that we've got a very powerful private interests in Britain that could set up think tanks that would basically steer foreign policy. And the trouble is now, as we've got small government, we've got right-wing party in the States and in Britain trying to reduce the size of government and increase the power of big business, that big business is actually calling the shots at Chatham House, not the Foreign Office.
At Chatham House in particular, it's American institutions like the Heritage Foundation and there are several others that are calling the shots. Chatham House is not objective. I was a member once, but it's not objective. It's completely tilted.
So every time you hear Chatham House on the BBC...
you're hearing the American spooks.
OK, well, we're not going to be hearing the American spooks now. We're going to go over to look at the what's been going on in Lebanon. Well, nothing much has been happening in Lebanon itself, but here in London, the Home Secretary Saeed Javid has now classing the political wing of Hezbollah, which is a major part in the government of Lebanon, as a terrorist organisation. So does that mean that if the foreign minister, who happens to be from Hezbollah, walks out of the Lebanese embassy in London, he's going to be arrested as a terrorist?
That's the implication. But anyway,
so let's have a listen now quickly, just before we go on to discuss that further, to Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire, which Andrei Vilcek was talking about then, mentioned. And I asked Patrick Henningsen about Hezbollah. What is Hezbollah? Clearly, it's a major feature of the government now in Lebanon. But what is it?
Hezbollah is a resistance movement which sprung out of South Lebanon and is a direct result. This is an important part, and I do recommend people reading a few good books on this, including Hala Jaber's book, which is entitled Hezbollah. They're a direct result of the Israeli occupation of South Lebanon. And so if Israel didn't occupy South Lebanon for the number of years that it did, there would be no Hezbollah, quite possibly. So it's a resistance movement and a defense force which emerged out of that situation. And, of course, after every civil war or after every war, militias will tend to move into politics This is not unusual. We see this in Ireland as well. We see this in many other places. In fact, this is the norm throughout history, and no different in Lebanon. This is exactly what's happened in Lebanon. So as they've matured and as they've moved and as the war subsided in Lebanon, then they moved into politics. They are a power bloc, but they have a religious element to them, and they have this terrorist allegations and history, whichever way you want to interpret that, which goes back to the early 1980s. And so they have been designated in the past as a terrorist group by the United States.
That's Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire.
What he's talking about is repeated throughout history. I mean, in Ireland, the British occupation after the rebellion became so onerous. The next thing is you've got an independent republic.
But what about this whole business? Saeed Javid is now saying officially in British law, Hezbollah political wing are terrorists.
Well, the Home Secretary has a wonderful record. Look at Windrush and all the rest of it. But he doesn't seem to see the contradiction. And, of course, this foreign minister of Lebanon will not be arrested outside the embassy. And our Home Secretary will be made to look the idiot he has been behaving like recently over other things.
Well, put this to Patrick about why is that Hezbollah and what is the truth to whether Hezbollah actually is a terrorist group or not, because it certainly has had a lot of terrorist attacks attributed to it.
The only argument that anybody's made in terms of Hezbollah being a terrorist organization goes back to the early 1980s, and they will always trot out the same arguments, which is that the Hezbollah did the U.S. Barracks bombing, which killed 240-odd Marines. Sorry if I get the number wrong on that. And that's taken as fact, when in fact, if you read the history of Hezbollah and what was going on in the Lebanese Civil War, Hezbollah wasn't fully formed by that time. But it's being automatically attributed, especially by the Americans and the Israelis, and as a Hezbollah terrorist attack, and it was being directed by the Iranian state, because I believe one of the drivers in this car bombing of what happened was Iranian. Okay, so this is how the narrative goes. This is how the story goes. There's another one. I think it was another attack. I believe it might have been in Saudi Arabia. I'm not sure. I don't have the details in front of me, but that was a U.S. investigation that deemed it to be Hezbollah. Then you have the Bulgarian bus bombing, which is a very dubious case to begin with, and Israel has attributed that to Hezbollah. The reality is Hezbollah defeated Israel on the battlefield in 2006 and effectively expelled Israel from occupying its buffer zone in South Lebanon. Okay. Now, that's historical fact, and if one's to comment on that, that was a defense operation by a sovereign state. Israel doesn't have a real claim on saying that was a terrorist organization that evicted them from Lebanon. That is the domestic defense force of southern Lebanon.
Patrick Henningsen again.
Very good. No, and this is... years ago, I was in Lebanon, and the appalling crisis that occurred there. But the Israeli invasion was a total disaster, and its bad effects are still there. But as you say, quite correctly, Israel has no rights in South Lebanon. It's an occupation force.
Well, it will say it's a buffer zone. It needs South Lebanon as a buffer zone.
Buffer zones don't exist in law. It's Lebanese territory, and if Israel has soldiers in there, then Israel is occupying the territory.
Well, interestingly, we had a newspaper editor from Hezbollah here in Bristol back in February 2008 at the council house, and there was a little bit of a protest. There was one of these Sayanim turned up who was basically pro-Israeli, trying to disrupt the whole affair. But actually, the chap gave, I thought, a fascinating insight into what's You know, actually, wasn't it the first library in the world in Lebanon, in Tyre or Byblos, maybe?
Byblos, almost certainly. Alexandria was the great one in historic times, but yes. It was an incredibly civilized country.
Going back away. And so let's have a listen now to just a clip from this talk, which was given by Ibrahim Moussaoui, who came all the way here to Bristol. There were some articles criticizing him in the press, but he was brought over by Stop the War and was an absolutely fascinating person to listen to here in the Council House here in Bristol in February 2008. So let's have a little clip now where he talks about self-defense in Lebanon.
If you want to tell the people that you don't want wars, what do? You have many things that you can do. You can demonstrate in the streets, voice out your anger, vent out your anger and say, I'm against it. You can take measures. But if it's your country, what do you have to do? It's your moral duty. It's your responsibility. And it is your right. A natural right, a human right. It's a human right. It's an international law right. It's the natural law, it's the human doctrine that you have to defend yourself and you have to protect your country and you have to liberate it. Our country under occupation, we did not go to any country and occupy it. We did not steal anybody's water or oil or there hasn't been any soil theft from the Lebanese side, from Hezbollah side. They have always fought on the Lebanese territories to protect Lebanese people and to liberate Lebanese territories from occupation and invasion. Do you call this terrorism? And when we do this, we are sending a very simple message. We're saying that life is too important to us. We love life. We respect life. It's a gift given by God, by our magnificent God, to be free souls, to live in complete dignity and freedom. Otherwise, no meaning for our life. When you are dignified, when you live with dignity and freedom and independence, then this is the life. And if you live under humiliation and occupation and oppression, this is the death. So you better live while your head is up and not live humiliated all of your life. That's why we fight. And we tell them, when we fight them back, we tell them the war is costly. You cannot come and invade. It's not a picnic. You're going to be killed as an invading force and as an occupation army.
So that's the voice there of Hezbollah's newspaper editor, and that's Ibrahim Moussaoui speaking in Bristol's Council House in February 2008. A very big audience. But his main point there, I suppose, Kevin, is self-defence or terrorism. And he got a big round of applause, and he's saying, well, we're actually doing self-defence. Do you call this terrorism?
No, I don't. It goes back, there's a cliche back in the 70s of one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. And that is what he is saying. But he has right on his side. He's speaking as a Lebanese person and the right to defend his country and indeed the lives of his people, which is an absolute right in all the charters, the UN charter and everywhere else. And provoking war in Lebanon was a total disaster. I mean, to take a sample back here, in 1972, the British Army shot just 12 people compared with losses elsewhere. And the IRA tripled in size overnight. And we found ourselves with a terrorist war that lasted 40 years. That was the price of shooting, of murdering 12 people.
So the Israeli government will see this as a victory. Hezbollah has been now classed as a terrorist organisation in Britain.
It's a propaganda victory, but it's a mistake in law and it's a mistake in reality.
What about little bit south of Lebanon is Israel, and we've got elections next month, well, it's March now, in April, over there because of the collapse of Netanyahu's coalition. And I spoke also to Patrick Henningsen about this whole idea of the far right now starting to move in, possibly for the first time in 30 years, into the Knesset, because Netanyahu may be doing deals with them. Well, he's being forced, in fact, to do deals with them.
So where do you go when you don't have allies? Where do you go to fish for for support, where you go to sort of the periphery of the pond to fish for potential allies. That also might sound familiar to some people. And so a desperate government, a desperate Likud party, a desperate Netanyahu has allied with the fringes of the Israeli right, the really hard right, of the, what is the equivalent of the Jewish National Front in Israel. So this is hugely problematic on a number of levels. One of the main levels in which this is hugely problematic is how this is interpreted by American Jewry and the American wing of the Israeli lobby. So they're going to have problems with this. America is not a monolithic, hardline Jewish population. There, it's a wide spectrum. It's a diverse mosaic, and there's a lot of liberal Jews in America that don't support the hardline policies of Benjamin Netanyahu, and even less so in recent years. And so it's an interesting time we're living in right now, where the Jewish lobby is much more aggressive. Certainly under the Trump administration, this is one of the most tightest presidents with Israel and with the Jewish lobby. The move of the embassy to Jerusalem was just the beginning of that. So while they're being aggressive, more aggressive and more sort of offensive in their political ambitions in America and in Britain, at the same time, there's a backlash that's forming two Israeli policies, and you can count some of that down to the increase in interest in the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement globally, and that is a direct result probably of Israeli operations like Protective Edge and some of these other sieges that have been put upon Gaza, which Israel calls anti-terror operations, but that Palestinians and their supporters globally will call state-sanctioned terrorism.
Patrick Henningsen again. Gaza, a bit of a difficult one, Kevin. I mean, terrorists, do you think the Israelis are right to say they're terrorists?
Well, the UN has just literally yesterday or this morning said that the shootings of the unarmed Palestinians and the children at the wire in Gaza is a crime against humanity, almost certainly. And again, to take the comparison, if the British Army has shot 189 unarmed children, press people, medical people, I mean, there'd be no end to it.
But well, Yuval Steinitz is in the Israeli cabinet, and it looks like in the new government, if Netanyahu manages to stay in power, he could well become foreign minister. And I thought it's quite interesting to look a little bit ahead at what kind of foreign minister we could be getting. And here he is speaking about Gaza a couple of months ago.
Well, personally, I always think that if you don't have serious strategic goals for a war or for a military campaign, don't do it. And I didn't see any serious plan to achieve something significant in Gaza. I mean, if we decide to occupy Gaza, to uproot the terrorist regime there, and to enable Abu Mazen to resume control of Gaza, then we have to consider it. We will pay a price for it. It's not easy to capture Gaza, casualties and other prices. Yes. But since this is not currently on the table, we don't have to go to a war without serious, significant targets.
Again, he's saying Gaza is a terrorist camp, effectively.
Well, certainly Gaza is full of people who oppose Israel because they have been ghettoized. Gaza is actually a ghetto. It's a Palestinian ghetto, but it's been created by Israel, and the conditions in Gaza are intolerable.
Anyway, let's have a listen now finally to the Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro. He's an American who is just speaking about, he was just about to do a speech actually, at a big Jewish convention, which is, generally speaking, most of the people there, a massive stadium full of them in the US, opposed to Zionism and opposed to the whole idea of the state of Israel.
According to Zionism, Jewish identity is political. It's national. According to Judaism, Jewish identity is completely religious. A Jew, by definition, is somebody who accepted the Jewish religion or who is defined as a Jew by the Jewish religion. According to Zionism, Jewish identity is political, and it's defined the same way we define the identity of any nationals, like a Frenchman or a Canadian. According to Judaism, Jewish identity is centered only around God and God's teachings, nothing else. According to Zionism, Jewish identity is centered around a nation state, which they randomly decided is the nation state that was created in 1948 that they call Israel. According to Judaism, a Jew is supposed to have certain character traits. He's supposed to eschew violence. He's supposed to oppose violence. He's supposed to be disgusted by violence. Even in the olden days when Jews had to defend themselves, that was considered nothing to glorify. Jews don't have military heroes. We have religious heroes. Our heroes are the righteous. Our heroes are the scholars. The heroes of the Zionists are the war heroes. The Jews have no national sites where wars took place, such as the Alamo in America. Jews are not militant. Jews are religious. Jews are, the way the Bible describes us, a nation of priests and a holy people. If people want to retain their Jewish identity, if they want to resist the propaganda that is churned out by Zionists and Zionism every day, then it is vital that they take proactive steps to defend themselves against it. Look, the Zionist propaganda is everywhere. We live in a world where every day this message that has been deliberately promulgated by the Zionists is fed to us. Israel, Jewish state, Israel, Jews, Israel, the Jewish people, Israel protects the Jews. It's all bogus.
That is Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro. Links again to that on our show page. Time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at this week, oneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. Hopefully, Martin Summers will be back. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
This hour, we are going to consider and listen to and enjoy the words of Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen master, the peace activist, the Buddhist monk, the global spiritual teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, who is 92 years old. It's incredible. He is 92 years old. He's had some health problems I'll mention in a little bit, but we have a lot of Thich Nhat Hanh today talking to you about generating and cultivating happiness and joy and satisfying relationships. Now, all that seems difficult in these times of upheaval and social and political turmoil and conflict and the kind of rhetoric, the very harsh rhetoric going around, the harsh actions being taken. But there is someone out there, Thich Nhat Hanh, who has a lot of insight into these matters, a lot of wisdom to share. He has traveled the world teaching people to cultivate and to mindfully take care of themselves and others. Thich Nhat Hanh is one of the most important and respected and beloved Zen masters and spiritual teachers living today. He's also a veteran peace activist. Dr. King nominated Thich Nhat Hanh for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1967. About 4 years ago, Thich Nhat Hanh suffered a severe stroke that paralyzed most of the right side of his body and took away his ability to speak. He went through rehab, and he has never fully recovered. In fact, that stroke took away his ability to speak, which, as at least as of last November, had not returned. last October 2018, after celebrating his 92nd birthday, he expressed a wish to return from France, where he had been based for many, many years at Plum Village, to Vietnam, to his temple, to the temple he was ordained in many, many decades ago. He expressed a wish to return to Vietnam to live his remaining days. And we have a enlightening thank you gift for listeners who want to pledge this hour to KPFA. It is a 6-CD box set, 6 hours of insights and teachings directly from Thich Nhat Hanh. It's called Happiness, Love, and Liberation, Insights and Teachings from Buddhist Psychology. And this 6-CD deluxe box set, Happiness, Love, and Liberation, is your thank you gift for a pledge of $20 a month to KPFA. $20 a month to KPFA, and ask for and receive this 6-CD set, 6 hours of Thich Nhat Hanh telling you a lot about Buddhist psychology, about your psychology, about social psychology, about how to gain fulfillment and a sense of peace of mind and equanimity, and how to relate to other people, how to talk to them, how to listen to them, what to think about and act upon when you are talking with somebody who is suffering, who is in trouble, in crisis, or just has a vague sense of disease about the world in all its aspects or any of its aspects. So the phone number here for you to call is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. That's easily remembered as 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You are calling out to me and to Kirsten Thomas, who's at the controls, and to everybody else here at KPFA. You want to support KPFA, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. I want to support KPFA. I want to get this, and for those of you who can give $20 a month, I want to get this 6-hour, 6-CD deluxe box set. So let's turn now to excerpts from this audio collection. Here is the Zen master, Thich Nhat Hanh.
In Buddhism, we speak of the 7 elements, the 7 factors of enlightenment. Enlightenment means deep understanding. In order to attain, to reach enlightenment, you need 6 factors. It's very interesting to see the Buddhist way of approaching the ultimate reality. And one of the factors of enlightenment is the factor relaxation, ease. If you are not relaxed, if you are tense, you cannot touch the ultimate. You cannot get enlightenment. So we have to practice releasing the tension and relax. When we sit, when we walk, when we meditate, relaxation is one of the factors of enlightenment. Ease. You have the feeling of lightness in your body, in your mind, and you have the feeling of peace. If you don't have that, don't hope for enlightenment. And there is another factor called factors of enlightenment. It's called joy. Joy. This is the Buddhist approach to knowledge, to understanding, to enlightenment. You need joy. So if you are a good practitioner, you should be able to generate joy. Otherwise, you cannot get enlightened. You cannot become a Buddha. You cannot get the right view. That is the Buddhist methodology, Buddhist approach. And then there is the element called mindfulness and concentration, of course. But here there is another factor that we call investigation. Investigation. With what kind of mind and you investigate reality and adopting what kind of methodology can you investigate into the heart of reality. In science, this would be the objects of physical science. It's like a galaxy, the moon, the earth, the atom, object of your investigation. You have to analyze, you have to look deeply, you have to find out what is the nature of what is there. That is the factor of investigation. When someone suffers and does not know how to handle the suffering in himself or herself, he becomes the victim of his own suffering. They cannot get out of that suffering. They cannot transform that suffering. And he can make other people around him suffer, around her suffer. It's not his intention to make you suffer. You suffer because that person does not know how to handle the suffering in himself. And that is why his suffering is spilled over. And you become the second victim. It's not his intention to make you suffer. You have to see that. And that person needs help. That person does not need punishment. What that person needs is help. And who is going to help him? You. You are a practitioner. You have to help yourself first. And then you will help him or her. If we know how to handle the suffering in us, if we can understand the nature of our own suffering, we suffer less. We feel lighter. We accept ourselves. We do not blame ourselves. We are at peace with ourselves. And you are in position to help him. You want him or her to do like you. And that is why you use the fourth mindfulness training. You come to him and say, "Darling, I know you suffer. And in the past, I did not understand the suffering. And I have reacted in such a way that make you suffer more and I suffer more. It's not my intention to make you suffer, dear one. It's because I did not understand your suffering. And I did not understand my suffering either. Now the situation is better. I have understood my suffering. And I want to understand your suffering. Because understanding your suffering, your difficulties, will help me to behave in such a way that can be helpful. So if you really care for, please help me. Tell me of what is in your heart. I want to listen. I want to understand. Tell me about your suffering, your difficulties. If you do not help me, who will? And that is loving speech. And when you have the energy of compassion in your heart, you can use that speech very easily. It's come very naturally. There are many people who hate their father, who can never say something sweet to their father. And yet after a few days of practice, looking at their own suffering and the suffering of their father, they were able to use loving speech. You have to practice breathing, walking, so that you are calm, that you can understand your own suffering and his or her suffering. And in just 3-4 days, there is transformation. And when you compose a number and you hear his voice, suddenly you find yourself capable of speaking like that, using the language of loving kindness. Daddy, I know that you have suffered a lot during the last many years. I could not help you. I only made the situation worse. I have reacted with anger and stubbornness because I did not understand your difficulty, your suffering. It's not my intention, Daddy, to make you suffer. It's about my ignorance, about my own suffering and your suffering. Now I have understood some are suffering. I feel much better. And I would like to know that it's not my intention to make you suffer, Father, just because I did not understand your suffering. So please help me. If you don't help me, who will? Tell me, Daddy, about your suffering, your difficulties. And they find it natural that they can speak like that just after 3-4 days of practice. And when you speak like that, the heart of the other person will open right away. And that person will tell you. And now you practice deep listening, compassionate listening. And 1 hour of listening like that will heal him, heal her very quickly. You are the bodhisattva of deep listening. If you know how to listen with compassion, you can heal. You can heal him, you can heal her, and you can heal yourself. The bodhisattva of deep listening is in your heart. The seat of understanding, the seat of compassion are well in you. And we need mindfulness in order to touch off these seats, in order to be able to understand, to be compassionate, and suddenly we find ourselves capable of talking like that and listening like that in order to restore communication and to heal. In any relationship, this is possible. Even between two groups of people, two nations, the practice of deep listening, the use of loving speech is very important. And if it happens that you are not satisfied, you are not proud of what you have thought, you have said, you can do something in order to return, to change. And it is wonderful to know that if you have the practice, then you don't have to run after that thought in order to try to catch up and change. You stay here in the right, in the here and the now. Because that action is a kind of force that is exerting its power on you and on others. And you stay right here and you breathe in, breathe out mindfully, and you say, I'm aware that the thought that I produced yesterday was not worth of me. It does not have enough compassion and forgiveness. I can do better. And being aware of that, in the here and the now, you will give rise to another thought that is full of compassion and awareness and forgiveness. And as soon as you have produced that thought, the thought produced can catch up in no time at all, the other thought, and delete it or transform it. That is wonderful concerning the practice. You don't have to go to the past in order to fix the past. You are there, right in the here and the now. And by using your mindfulness, concentration, you create understanding and compassion, and you can change even the past. You can change even the future. Remember the story of Mahamaya, who was pregnant of Siddhartha. The way she lived is very important. The way she spent her hours and her days is very important for Siddhartha. Our children, even if you are still a young person, we are not a mother or a father yet, but our children are already there in potential, as potential. Only time is needed for them to manifest. And the way we live our daily life affect them already. Our children and grandchildren will be happy or not, it depends on how we live our day to day. If we drink alcohol, if we destroy our liver, if we allow ourselves to be victims of despair, and that is not good for our children in us. So in the here and now, you can affect the present, not only the present, you can affect, you have the power on the past, and you have the power on the future. That is why mindfulness practice is to learn how to handle the present moment. And if you handle the present moment the best you can, you are doing everything you can do in order to change the past and prepare for the future. There is freedom. Free will is possible with mindfulness.
The voice of Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen master and Buddhist monk and teacher and author and poet. I'm C.S. Song. This is special KPFA Fun Drive programming coming to you during KPFA's Winter Fun Drive. And we are trying to make some money for KPFA, and we are doing our best to give you a wonderful thank you gift in return for your pledge of support. So what are we giving? What are we handing you in return for a pledge? If you can give $20 a month to KPFA, you get 6 hours on 6 CDs of Thich Nhat Hanh. The name of the box set is called Happiness, Love, and Liberation, Insights and Teachings from Buddhist Psychology. But you know, the more I listen to this box set, and I've listened to almost all of it over a period of time, the more I'm inclined to call it How to Live. It's about how to live. It's about how to live, not necessarily, not even in the moments of crisis or extremity. It's about how to live at those moments so that you can stay sane and keep your head and make the best decisions you can make at the time. But it's about how to live every day, about what to do every day, about how to conduct yourself, about how to adjust or readjust your attitudes, about how to think about all the kind of conventional messages we've been given over time and to question them and to question the authority of them and to look and find new ways, look for and find new ways of being in this world, being with yourself, being with other people, being with your community. 1-800-439-5732 is the phone number. Toll free, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. For a $20 a month pledge to KPFA, you get not 1 hour or 3 hours or 4.5 hours, but 6 hours of Thich Nhat Hanh speaking to you on 6 CDs. It's a wonderful gift, but it's also a wonderful gift to you for just yourself, if that's how you want to do it. And it is our gift to you for a pledge of $20 or more a month to KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. We have more Thich Nhat Hanh, much more to present this hour, but do consider going to your phones or pledging online at kpfa.org, kpfa.org. This is your ticket to, this box set is your ticket to one of today's most important and beloved spiritual teachers. In fact, next to the Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh is the best known Buddhist teacher in the world. His teachings have touched millions. Millions have flocked to see this man who is now 92 years old and who is ailing, but still hanging in there in Vietnam at the temple he was ordained at, I believe, at the age of 16. Oh, well, it was in 1949 he was ordained as a monk, and he was born in 1926, so that was the age of 23 years old. He joined a Zen monastery in Vietnam at the age of 16, and he studied Buddhism as a novitiate, and he has done a tremendous amount over time to spread the word about Buddhism without proselytizing. He's not about trying to convert people to Buddhism or to anything. He's about lending the insights he's learned from Buddhism and other Eastern traditions to your life, to make your life better, to make your mind more at peace, to make your situation more bearable, to make your suffering less intense, to make the suffering of people you know less intense, to help you communicate, to help you understand, to clearly grasp a situation, whether it be an interpersonal situation or a situation having to do with your place in the wider world. This is about intimacy, about what I would call true intimacy. It's about deep listening. It's about compassion, which is an easy word to invoke. You know, we need to be more compassionate. But how does one actually practice it? How does one be more compassionate? What does compassion mean? And when the rubber hits the road, because we can all talk about compassion just kind of in the abstract, but when we're dealing with difficult situations with family members, with friends, with people, with acquaintances, that is when I suggest to you that compassion has to be practiced, is to be practiced, and that is when it is the most difficult. So he has so much in here to commend to you, to suggest to you. 1-800-439-5732 is the phone number. $20 a month gets you this six CD, six hour audio box set called Happiness, Love, and Liberation. There are breathing exercises in here. He will guide you through breathing exercises, including ones to help you generate a joyful feeling and ones to help you take care of your body and one on how to generate happiness. And, you know, we're going to get back to Thich Nhat Hanh, but you hear about like joy and happiness and it all sounds kind of fluffy. Well, it can sound kind of fluffy and just kind of Pollyannish and, hey, let's all smile together. No, this is he's talking about something else here. He's talking about a deep and abiding comfort with oneself and with one's situation. To the maximum extent possible, of course. He doesn't want us to ignore our social conditions or interpersonal conditions, our political situation. But he is suggesting a path to happiness, not of the superficial, let's all, you know, smile and laugh together, but happiness as a profound state of being, as a way of being in the world, not just in the moment, but in every moment. By being in the moment, by being part of the present and staying connected to the present. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. $20 a month gets you this six CD, 6 hour audio box set. Let's return now to hear more from this box set by Thich Nhat Hanh. It's called Happiness, Love, and Liberation.
This is very important in Buddhism because in Buddhism we distinguish two kinds of truth. The conventional truth and the ultimate truth. In the conventional realm of truth, you can speak of birth and death, being and non-being, you and I, time and space as separate entities. And you can apply that kind of knowledge into technology and into your daily life also. For instance, every one of us need a birth certificate in order to have an identity card and a passport. Without that, you cannot you cannot go anywhere. You cannot say that, well, my nature is the nature of no birth and no death. I don't need a birth certificate. You see? So this kind of conventional truth does help. Yeah. And in the ultimate truth, we know that it's impossible for a cloud to die. A cloud cannot pass from the realm of being into non-being. That is the ultimate truth. But when someone dies, you have to declare that he has died. You cannot say that, well, he can never die. He's like a cloud. So I don't need to declare his death. You cannot do that. So in the conventional truth, we make use of notions of birth and death, being and non-being, you and I are different. Father and son are two distinct persons. You cannot mix up. Although in the ultimate truth, you can see the father in the son. If you remove the father from the son, he can no longer be there. You might like to invite your father to sit with you and to breathe with you. Our father is fully present in every cell of our body. And that is why when we invite our father to sit with us, he will do that. And with your invitation, he will do it. Breathing in, I invite my father to breathe in with me. Father and son, enjoy breathing in. You can practice like that. Breathing out, I invite my mom to enjoy breathing out with me. Breathing out, mother and daughter, enjoy breathing out together. So your mother will be very real. And you are breathing in and out with your mother. Your mother in you is not a mental construction. She is real. She has transmitted herself to you. And every cell of your body, your mother is there. If you sit beautifully and you smile happily, your mother in every cell of you also smile beautifully. And this is a miracle that you can perform right in here and now. You have encountered the Buddha Dharma. It means that our parents have encountered the Buddha Dharma. You have encountered the Buddha Dharma. You know the practice. That is why all our ancestors encountered the Buddha Dharma. And you can invite all your ancestors to enjoy breathing in and breathing out with you. You are not an isolated being. You have no separate self. You are made of ancestors. And when you breathe out relaxingly, all your ancestors in you breathe in now, breathe out relaxingly. We have to see that. That is only insight. There is no separate self. We are a current. We are a stream. We are a continuation. We are a continuum. And that you have to see. We have learned that the self is made only of non-self elements. And when the self breathes in, all non-self elements are breathing in. And we have blood ancestors in us. We have spiritual ancestors in us. Suppose you are reaching out for something sweet to eat. A cake, a big piece of cake. And because you have learned mindfulness, suddenly you are aware that you are doing so. And you are reaching out. And mindfulness helps you to ask, why I'm reaching out for the cake? I'm not hungry. Why do I have to eat? And many of us are like that. And you may get the insight that there's some worry in you, some anxiety in you, some irritation in you, and you automatically reach out something to eat and then forget to cover up the loneliness, the irritation in you, and that has become a habit because that has been settled as a neural pathway in your brain. And as a practitioner, you have to change the way to change the neural pathway. Otherwise, the habit energy will always lead you to suffering. You should allow mindfulness and concentration to intervene in order for you to not to become again and again the victim of that suffering. Suppose you are in a discussion group and you have a chance to speak up about your suffering. And you may choose to speak in your suffering. You might follow the old way remember the suffering and express your suffering in a way that will make you suffer like other times. Are you my shoes? Another way. And while speaking, you use mindfulness and concentration.
Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist teacher and Zen master, and poet and peace activist. I'm C.S. Song. This is KPFA Special Fund Drive Programming. Thich Nhat Hanh is speaking on this 6-CD, 6-hour deluxe box set. It's called Happiness, Love, and Liberation. Although, as I said earlier, I think this is about how to live, in essence. And I'm delighted to offer, as a thank you gift, this 6-CD set for a $20 pledge to KPFA, or $250 all at once if you like. You can get these insights from Thich Nhat Hanh, 1-800-439-5732. We will return to more of Thich Nhat Hanh, but I'm going to give you more than enough time to make the 2 or 3 minute phone call at 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Or you can donate online at kpfa.org. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh knows about the profound joy of giving. And I bet you're going to feel some of that profound joy when you give to KPFA. When I get off the phone line after I give to something, let's say I'm making a financial pledge, I feel great. I feel like giving is as wonderful a part of life as taking. In fact, I think giving is more wonderful. When we give a friend something that they enjoy, that they like, that they need, that they want, that can give us a tremendous amount of pleasure, more than maybe even receiving a gift from a friend. Well, we're asking you for a gift, but we have a wonderful, perhaps priceless gift to give in return, this 6-CD, 6-hour box set from Thich Nhat Hanh. $20 a month, 1-800-439-5732. And yes, some of the money that you give goes to KPFA, but you know, we have to go out and purchase, fortunately at a discount, this 6-CD box set. And that money, much of it goes to Thich Nhat Hanh and his community. So you are supporting KPFA, and you are supporting Thich Nhat Hanh, and you are supporting yourself all at once, because you are going to get some amazing wisdom and insights into how to live your life and how to be the best friend and parent and child and sibling and relative and acquaintance, best person you can be to those around you, people who are doing well, people who have a sense of unease, people who are in extremity. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. As I get older, I deal with more suffering. People around me are getting older. They're having more physical problems. They're having sometimes problems around life goals, a sense of disease about what they've been doing all these years, whether they should have been doing something else, regrets. There are people I know who are dying. Relatives get older, illness becomes more prominent, and sometimes our relationships with people get more difficult as we, I don't know, I wouldn't say adjust, but as we come to terms with the fact that, well, you know, maybe I haven't talked to that person in a while. We haven't been on speaking terms, or there's this friction that's been around for much too long. And this could be with a parent, but it also could be with a friend or a former dear friend. Thich Nhat Hanh lends his considerable insights into all of these situations. And that you might find more valuable, what you learn from him and what you are able to practice as a result of getting this 6-CD, 6-hour audio box set for a $20 a month pledge to KPFA. You might find all of that much more valuable than what you are giving to KPFA right now. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I want to thank Anne in San Francisco. Her comment is she thanks her husband, Francisco. Sue in Aptos, California. Alicia in Sausalito, California. Richard in Berkeley. We've also had people call in from Sebastopol and Palo Alto and Kailua, Hawaii, with a comment, thank you for all you do. So you don't have to be a KPFA radio listener. You don't have to be a KFCF radio listener, although we love listeners to both of those radio stations. You can be someone who listens on the web at kpfa.org. You can be someone who subscribes to and receives podcasts from KPFA. You can be someone who cares about KPFA, who is not in Berkeley or the Bay Area or Northern California or California or the Western U.S. or the U.S. You can be someone out there who just appreciates what KPFA has given you over time and who wants to give. KPFA.org, wherever in the world you have an internet connection, you can connect with us, and you can also donate online right now. And you can choose, if you like, the $20 a month subscription, which allows you the Happiness, Love, and Liberation by Thich Nhat Hanh as your thank you gift. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We just had a caller call in from Rohnert Park. Oh, this was an online pledge. Thank you so much for your love for Gaia and your work for her and all beings. May KPFA receive the funding it needs to stay on the air and continue its work. Thank you. Thank you. There's a lot of gratitude in this message. Thank you for that. Please give the credit to the following program, Against the Grain. Thank you very much to that. So join the people who've called. Join the people who've expressed a certain kind of generosity this hour, and also maybe have made the shrewd decision that getting something as valuable in return as this 6-CD, 6-hour audio box set, Happiness, Love, and Liberation, is a fantastic deal, is a fantastic thing to do. So let's return now to more of Happiness, Love, and Liberation. Before I do that, I want to say that in the remaining 19 minutes of the hour, we've been given a match by James in Los Altos, Vicky in San Francisco, Gania, I believe it is, G-A-N-I-L-L-A in San Francisco, and John in Vallejo. And they've pooled their money, and they are willing to, or we have, and you are challenged to the tune of $600. So if you give $20 a month, we get $40 a month. Basically, your dollars are doubled, but only until the end of the hour or until we make this match of $600. So make your pledge go farther if you like. This is a great time to call 1-800-439-5732. Give us a call. Tell us that you're there, that you care, and learn how to care more for yourself and for others by getting not one, not three, but 6 hours of Thich Nhat Hanh. Let's return now to more of Thich Nhat Hanh.
With mindfulness and concentration and insight, we can very well generate a feeling of joy to nourish ourselves and to generate a feeling of happiness whenever we want. We know that when we begin to breathe in mindfully, we bring our mind home to our body, and suddenly we are fully present in the here and the now. And established in the here and the now, we are able to recognize the many conditions of happiness that are available in the here and the now. More than enough for us to be happy. You know that the French has a very good song called Qu'est-ce qu'on attend pour être heureux? Why do you wait in order to be happy? You can be happy right now, right here. Because when you are home to the here and the now, you discover that so many conditions of happiness available already. You don't have to go to the future and look for some more conditions of happiness. And these conditions of happiness are more than enough. And that is why mindfulness, the that can help us go home to the here and the now and recognize all these conditions of happiness are already there. That can already help us to generate a feeling of joy. And another way of generating joy and happiness, allowing joy and happiness to come, is through the practice of releasing. You might think that to have more fame can make you happier. You might think that to have more money, more power will make you happy, more sex will make you happy. You are caught by these ideas. And that is why you might be tempted to run after these objects of your desire. And many of us are running after these objects and suffer very deeply. And that is why release them, to let go of that idea that happiness cannot be without fame and power and wealth and sex. And that is why let go, releasing, is a source of happiness. And in Buddhism, we speak of joy and happiness generated by the act of releasing. Joy and happiness are born from the act of releasing. Let go. This is done very quickly. If you are released, if you are capable to release that, you can be happy right away. You don't have to go anywhere to get happiness. One day the Buddha was sitting with his monks, and a farmer went by. He stopped and asked, "My dear monks, have you seen my cows going through here?" The Buddha said, "What cows?" He said, "Well, I have a number of cows, but I don't know why this morning they all run away. They have run away. I cannot find them. And I have a few acres of sesame seed plant, and the insect ate them all. So I think I'm going to kill myself." And the Buddha said, "Dear friend, we have not seen your cows passing over here. You may like to go and look for them in the other direction." And after the farmer was gone, the Buddha turned back to his monks, looking at them and smiled. And he said, "My dear friends, you are very lucky. You don't have any cows to lose." So the techniques, the secret is how to release your cows. So if you are a good practitioner, take a sheet of paper and write down the names of your cows on the sheet of paper and try to release them. The more you release, the happier you become. And that is the techniques provided by the Buddha. Consciousness cannot be described either as strictly individual or strictly collective. Suppose we speak of our body as something that belongs to ourselves, and it affects only us, but that is not true. Because the way we are can affect everyone. You can say that your optic nerves only concern you. But if you are a bus driver, the life of other people depend on your optic nerves. So your optic nerve is not exactly an individual thing. It is a collective thing also. Everything has to do with everything else. We have our body, we have our consciousness, and each of us has our electromagnetic field reaching out. We are always reaching out to other things. We can compare that to the notion of force field in modern physics. The force field is a kind of energy that we exert on other things, one thing exert on other things. And that is why you are in me and I am in you. Our presence has an effect on everything else in the cosmos. And the way we are can cause more suffering or can cause more happiness or well-being to the other person. when we know how to generate the energy of understanding and compassion, not only we bring well-being and happiness into us, but that kind of energy is reaching out and help the other people to transform and to suffer less. We are not only in here, we are everywhere. Our presence is non-local. So we can speak of everything in terms of energy, in terms of potentials, in terms of seeds. And with the practice, we can get more freedom. With the practice, we can purify our mind so that the ultimate reality, the ultimate truth will reveal to us. When the mind is pure, when the mind is free, and then reality will reveal itself totally here. And we don't have to look for the ultimate elsewhere.
The mind will be free. You know, one of the words in the title of this 6-CD audio program is called Happiness, Love, and Liberation. This is a lot about liberation as advised by Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen master, the spiritual teacher, the global spiritual teacher, the author, the poet, the veteran peace activist. Happiness, Love, and Liberation, the 6-CD audio box set, yours for a pledge of $20 a month to KPFA. KPFA may be worth $20 a month to you, and then you get, in addition to that, 6 hours of insights from one of the most important spiritual teachers today. And of course, there's a lot of interest in Buddhism and in Eastern thought and Eastern philosophy, and Thich Nhat Hanh can be your guide or one of your guides, and he is certainly a person you can put your trust into. 1-800-439-5732 is the phone number. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. $20 a month. $20 a month gets you this thank you gift, Happiness, Love, and Liberation, 6 hours. There is really so much to talk about here, so much to riff off of what we just heard. And again, you've just heard a very small portion or proportion or excerpt of this 6-CD, 6-hour audio box set. But he talks a lot about, you know, we are caught by ideas. We are caught by ideas. It's not just that ideas have influence over us. It's that we are caught by them. We are trapped by them. We are held in thrall by these ideas. And so we act in so many ways that are detrimental to our well-being and the well-being of others because of the hold that conventional ideas have on us. And it's hard not to be socialized into believing that these ideas are good, that they lead to happiness, they lead to joy, they lead to satisfaction, they lead to comfort. And Thich Nhat Hanh is trying to tell you that, no, there is another way, and there has to be another way, because otherwise we get ourselves into a great deal of trouble and needless suffering and destructive relationships and alienation on both a personal and an interpersonal and environmental level and social level. He is saying there's another way, and I want to help you figure it out. And if you listen to Thich Nhat Hanh, there's a kind of meditative and hypnotic quality to his voice, not in the sense that he is trying to hypnotize you into believing him and giving you money and joining his cult or anything like that. He has no cult. But he is allowed, he helps, I think his voice helps us, helps me attain a kind of grounding and a place of repose and relaxation where we can really focus on what's true and what's real and on what it means to live mindfully and to listen deeply, how to listen with compassion, how to, in the process of listening with compassion, heal yourself and heal other people. Now, we have 7 minutes left, and I was given a match of $600, which means every dollar is doubled up to $600 collectively. And we have gone $250 the way toward this match, which ends, unfortunately, in 6.5 minutes. So for those of you who can give money of any amount, whether it be $25, which gives you a basic membership at KPFA, or $100, or $250, or $20 a month, whatever you can give, your dollars are doubled. And this means that we can accept this conditional pledge from James and Vicky and Ganilla or Ganilla and John. So it's an important time to call. It's an important time to get something of value to you. And, you know, we have all kinds of things here. We have KPFA gear. We have books and films. You may have heard something some other hour this fund drive that really appealed to you. You can call up 1-800-439-5732, and you can ask for whatever you like or whatever you remember we have, or you can say, well, what do you have in the way of T-shirts or socks or water bottles or whatever your heart desires. But, you know, a lot of people, a significant proportion of people, give just out of the goodness of their own hearts, in the sense that, you know, they don't want anything in return because they know that adds expenses to what KPFA is doing, administrative, and, you know, we have to acquire what we're going to give to you. So if you want to do that, then we get the maximum value of your donation. 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. We have one person on the line. I'd like to make that two or three, because otherwise we can't get to this $600 level. Can you join that one person on the line and give a call and join people like Jane in Walnut Creek? Thank you so much for your pledge. Beatrice in San Francisco, thank you. There have been pledges from Mimi in Berkeley and Kat in San Jose and Herb in El Cerrito and Nan in Sebastopol and Marcia in Oakland and Phoebe in Berkeley. And I'm going back to last hour as well. Elizabeth in Walnut Creek, Janice in Woodside, California, Mary V in Boulder Creek, California, Jean in Forestville, Mary in Tulare. There's this whole amazing community out there that takes a kind of responsibility for their listening and understands that, yes, we are not asking, we are not requiring anybody to give money for KPFA to get KPFA. But, you know, for KPFA to exist and continue, given that we don't get underwriting, we don't have commercials, advertising, corporate sponsors, it means that money has to come from somewhere. And we've decided we're going to stay pure, and we are going to ask you, the listener, to support KPFA. So we are beholden to you, not to a big oil company, not to a branding agency or a wealth management company or a bank or some other private entity. 1-800-439-5732. We could use more volunteers in the phone room if you want to help us that way. Come down during kind of regular business hours, and we are at 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley. That's Martin Luther King Jr. Way and University Avenue. We're about a half block north of that. And come on by and meet fellow listeners and volunteers and meet some of the programmers who invariably walk through. And there's a little food and drink, and you can help us take calls. 1-800-439-5732. I've been asked to thank Stella Nona Restaurant of Berkeley for the lunch that they have donated. And thanks to our neighbors, Cafe Nostos, for the coffee they've donated to the staff and volunteers working on the KPFA fund drive. We have now two people on the line. That increases our chances. But we only have 2.5 minutes left to make this match. So if one or two more of you go to your phones and pledge $20 a month, we can get to that $600 match total pretty quickly, 1-800, and that'll be have to be the way it is because we have to do this very quickly. 2 minutes left, 1-800-439-5732. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. This is about being. It's about listening with compassion. It's about healing yourself, healing others, taking action, not just thinking about taking action, but taking action on the mental, emotional, and spiritual levels, and staying present. Staying present is a very easy thing to say, hey, you know, just kind of stay in the present and be here and all that. No, with the help of mindfulness exercises that Thich Nhat Hanh provides to you as part of this six-hour audio box set, you can learn what it really means, what it means to stay present. And staying present means thinking clearly, and thinking clearly means evaluating your situation accurately, and thinking and evaluating your situation accurately will allow you to act in the world in a more measured, a more appropriate, a more efficacious way. Buddhists often talk about that, how to be more efficacious, how to be more effective, how to be more compassionate as well. 1-800-439-5732.
Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio. TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Kevin Anderson, Talk to the Oxford Climate Society. On January 25, 2019, Professor Kevin Anderson, the Chair of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester, spoke at the Oxford Climate Society. He's one of the rare academics with a background in mechanical engineering, even worked on oil platforms as a young man. In addition to producing peer-reviewed research, he engages with European governments on issues ranging from shale gas, aviation, and shipping. He also brings a strong sense of justice and equity into his recommendations on how to prevent climate chaos. He said that it's 28 years since the IPCC's first report on climate change, and over a quarter of a century since the 1992 Rio Earth Summit. Now in 2019, and with the benefit of hindsight, we can trace our voyage of abject failure, he says, and with humility learn lessons for charting an alternative low-carbon course. Kevin Anderson also said, we need to explore how academia has abdicated its responsibility to hold government to account. Here's Kevin Anderson, starting off with his most compelling argument.
If just the top 10% global emitters reduce their carbon footprint to the level of the average European, so just the average EU citizen actually, and the other 90% make no reductions, no increases, but no reductions. They just carry on as they're today. Would there be any major reduction in global emissions? If so, what sort of size do you think you might see? Any ideas? Well, it's about a one-third cut in global emissions. And just bear in mind that the Paris pledges have no reduction by 2030. So that shows how keen we are on climate change. My provocation is that the shrinking budgets we have for 2 degrees centigrade, or indeed 1.5, together with highly unequal responsibility for carbon dioxide, and I'll be drawing that out during this presentation, embed equity at the heart of real mitigation. I couldn't have said that in 1990, 2000, perhaps by 2005, 2010, definitely equity becomes important. By 2019, it's absolutely at the heart of responding to climate change. I'll try and show why that is the case now. The issue of the asymmetric distribution of wealth, again, that's only because we've left it so late, underpins our ongoing failure to tackle climate change. This is my provocation. And that only when we acknowledge that will we move away from the incremental nonsense that we've done for the last 30 years to something that's much more akin with the system change that is now demanded for 2 degrees centigrade of warming. We're still dominating this in the news. There's only two things in the news are Brexit and Davos. This is the sort of view that I still hold of Davos, very much along these sort of lines. And we're doing just fine with the Davos thing. We mustn't disturb the dominant socioeconomic paradigm, ongoing growth, resources and power skewed to a privileged few who look after the rest of us, look down on us and make sure the world works well for us. In the climate discussions there, some of you will have seen this in the papers, covered by a lot of the papers, there were between 1,000 and 1,500 private jets flying the morally bereft to Davos to discuss issues around climate change. And it's about time we called these people out. But on climate, I would argue the Davos paradigm is legitimised. So in relation to climate change, I think it's fair to say pejoratively referred to as the climate glitterati, whether that's Bloomberg, DiCaprio, Nick Stern, Christiana Figueres, Al Gore, or Mark Carney. But all these people have, you know, absolutely huge carbon footprints and then tell the rest of the world about what we need to do about climate change as they fly around in first class or business jet or their private business planes. But they're supported by a whole cadre of senior academics. So the academic community is desperately trying to ingratiate themselves with this group. They'll embed offsetting, negative emissions, geoengineering, carbon capture and storage, green growth, anything there that maintains evolution in relation to climate change within the system. The last thing we can do is propose something that may actually question the system. We mustn't do that. That's not to say those things in isolation might have some role to play, but collectively they're our dominant paradigm. So we've got Davos, but basically you can change it for COP. When I was there this year, and you go along to the side events and you'll just hear repeatedly wonderful stories about how every country's been doing, often supported by senior academics and NGOs. And then you think, well, hang on, the emissions went up by 2.7%. How can that be the case if every country's doing really well? Someone somewhere is lying. So this is a provocation. So let's put some bones on that provocation. So the international agenda, I mean, this is stuff you're all going to know, I suppose, so I'm going through it quite quickly. Climate change, Paris commitment, hold well below 2, ideally aim for 1.5. And the reason we went, the argument was for 1.5, that many people are fully aware at 2 degrees C, lots of people will die. Probably quite a few people will die at 1.5. And let's also be clear that we know who they are, and we've known for a long time. There'll be low emitters, they'll be a long way from here, they'll typically be non-white. So we know who they are. And we've known that for the last 20 years, and we haven't cared. Let's be blunt about that. Paint the picture as it is. We haven't cared. But fortunately, in Paris, that community did start to put a bit of pressure on the world and came up with this idea of should we aim for 1.5? And it certainly, with the 1.5 report, does suggest that there are merits to that. Also, that we would take action in accordance with the best science, and very importantly, on the basis of equity. That was embedded in the agreement, embedded in every agreement we've had back to Kyoto Protocol. And yet, when you look at it, no country takes any notice of equity, including the UK, including the Committee on Climate Change, the new Swedish climate change law. Equity is just dismissed out of hand. A bit of lip service, but that's about it. And I'll come back to that later. I'm not going to go into the 1.5 report, but just a couple of quick reflections from it. Initially, I was really quite negative about us having a 1.5 degree C report because I don't think it's achievable. Nevertheless, I think I've changed my mind a little bit since it came out. I'm to just draw two headline conclusions from it. There's obviously a lot of wonderful work in there. And the first one, I think, is really important, is to recognise that it does appear that from an impacts point of view, the impacts are much worse at 2 degrees centigrade than 1.5. So half a degree may not sound much to most of us, but particularly if you live in Manchester, I mean, we'd like some more warmth, really. But actually, when you look at it in terms of ecosystem impacts, in terms of additional risks of feedbacks, and also lots of more people impacted by climate change seriously, between 2 and 1.5. So 1.5, you can definitely see good reasons for going there. But then when you look at the mitigation story, it's the usual sort of thing, loads and loads of negative emissions, anything to delay action. So the way I see it is we have to aim for 2 degrees centigrade with what I call real mitigation, which is actually reducing our emissions. And maybe that's to be complemented with some sort of planetary scale negative emissions, which if they work at scale, great. And I'm all for let's fund a really good program of looking into these things, but let's not assume they work. Let's assume they don't work. But let's fund some good research into them. You know, the IPCC claim that few trade-offs and strong synergies between 1.5 mitigation and economic growth, Does anyone actually believe that? You know, what we'd have to do for 1.5 somehow fits with a growing economy. I think really no one's really thought that through. That's just there to assuage the economic sensibilities of our political system. However we may wish, climate change is ultimately a rationing issue. We've got to ration out our very limited amount of carbon emissions. And we don't like the idea of rationing, but that's what it is. There's no neat way out of that. Ignoring the huge inequality in emissions again, the IPCC chooses to construct its policy advice to neatly fit with the current economic model. So let's go back to 2 degrees centigrade of framing. The first IPCC report came out before most of your parents met. Think about that. Quite a lot of you here. Your parents hadn't met, and we had the first report from the IPCC, which told us basically everything we needed to know to respond to climate change. So during all of your life, your parents and people of my generation have chosen to fail you. We had the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. Probably a few of you then weren't even born. Yet in 2018, emissions were 65%, almost 65%, so higher than in 1990. 2018, they look that they've risen by about 2 to 3%, 2.7% is the best guess at the moment from the Global Carbon Project. So despite all this, we've actually seen emissions still going up. Just think that. Emissions are still rising 28 to 29 years after the first IPCC report. Despite all the optimistic rhetoric and smiling, grinning policymakers, entrepreneurs and academics, we've had 28 years of abject failure on climate change. And I think it's worth just reminding how appallingly we've failed. It's not that we haven't brought the emissions down, we've just watched them go up. And in fact, since 2000, the rate at which they've gone up is even faster than during the 1990s. And why have we seen this? Well, there's a whole suite of reasons, but I think it is important to sort of capture a few of the things that have helped us avoid any action. Offsetting. Let's pay the poor people to diet for us. If you want to lose weight, you can't ask someone else to cut back on the chocolate. And it's the same with climate change. You can't ask someone else to do it for you. Yet we then sanction that at a government level with a clean development mechanism. As soon as you start to give these things an official sounding name, they sound like they actually mean something in the real world, which of course they don't, other than procrastination. So that was state-sanctioned offsetting. Then we had the emissions trading scheme. We let's have so many permits issued that the price of carbon remains virtually zero. Now that's changing, but it's been a long time since the EUTS was actually there. So in the interim, it's been used as an excuse again for inaction. You can just look at the literature in the UK about that. Then we have this idea now of afforestation, plant a tree, grow an airport. That's the argument that's been made for the main airport in Stockholm in Sweden. We can expand the Arlanda airport because we're going to plant more trees in Sweden. And if all that fails, as it's going to, then we're relying on speculative negative emissions at huge planetary scale. Astronomical levels of negative emissions are assumed in most of the models. I'm not saying that they won't work, but we also don't know if they will. And there's certainly a lot of concern about whether they work at any planetary scale. And when that lot doesn't work, we're going to have a sticking plaster called geoengineering. So we're not going to try and solve the problem. We're going to put something over the top of it and mask it. Again, maybe there are some merits for that, perhaps for some sort of select ecosystems, if we can control it in some way. But the idea that this is what we're doing, and yet we have not tried yet to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions. So we've had climate change. We've had a good understanding since 1990, if not before. And we haven't tried to reduce our emissions. We've tried all this lot, though. And it's easy to turn around, as you'll find lots of co-opted academics in the UK will do, and the NGOs, and say, well, look, the UK is doing really well. We've got green growth here. We're at decoupling. Sweden says that, Denmark says that, and France says it. So the four sort of European climate progressive countries. And yet, when you actually look at it, there's no change in our emissions since, virtually no change in our emissions since 1990. The UK is a slight exception. It's come down at 0.4% per annum. Yeehaw. 0.4% from 1990. Once you factor in aviation and shipping, which most of the analysis conveniently ignore, I don't know who takes responsibility for those emissions. It must be God. No country takes responsibility for them. They're every country trying to grow them. And imports and exports. You take those into account, operating UK PLC and these other countries have seen no reduction since 1990. Norway is up 50%, Ireland's up 25%. I could get this wrong. I think it's either Belgium or the Netherlands, so I should really check. One of those is up by about 25%. So you just don't see much success, even in what are often seen to be climate progressive countries. So let's not pretend that we've succeeded. So once you've laid out really where we are now, as I would see it, and you may disagree with some of the numbers, most of them just come from government stats, where do we go from here? Now, well, we've got the AR5 reports from the IPCC, and I'm going to summarise them in one sentence, which is obviously clearly very unfair. It's carbon budgets that matter. And I know that there'll be some people here, as I'm looking over there, that would slightly disagree with that view, but I think it's probably quite nuanced, but we can discuss that maybe later. It's not long-term targets. What we do by 2050 doesn't really matter if we just leave it out till 2040 before doing anything. So think of it this way. It's, you know, the temperature relates to the total amount of CO2 we dump in the atmosphere and the concentration in the CO2 in the atmosphere. So if we decide to expand Heathrow Airport, or just as we have done now, just celebrate the launch of a new oil platform, the Clare Ridge platform, 50,000 tonnes of CO2 a day from that oil platform, the life expectancy from BP is it'll put out another 250 million tonnes. That platform only went out in December, celebrated by Claire Perry, the Minister for Energy and Clean Growth, during the Katowice COP. The other day I was at another event at a court case trying to stop some more shale gas development in the northwest. Shale gas development, 75% is methane, 75% by weight of it is carbon. So when you burn it, you get lots of CO2. So we've got Heathrow, shale gas, new oil platforms. So that's what this is. And then next generation have to do this, have to suck it out of the atmosphere in some way or find some very fast ways of mitigation. So it's the air end of the curve that matters. So every day we choose to fail now, we are passing again generationally the burden onto some of you here. So how big is the budget? And this is where we can have a lot of arguments as to how big the budget is, and I'm going to come back to that a little bit later, but I think it can be a bit of a technical distraction to some extent. So going from AR5, and we could argue we should use the stuff from the 1.5 report, but there are some reasons why I'm not doing that here. We've probably got about 700 billion tonnes of CO2 left. Now, it could be a bit higher than that, it could be a bit lower than that, and I'll touch on that in a minute. But something like that. That's the same sort of range that the IEA used, same starting values from the International Energy Agency or the recent Roxham paper. So it's not an uncommon sort of starting point. And we dump about 43 billion tonnes of CO2 in the atmosphere each year at the moment. That's about 16 years of current emissions. Something like that. So if you want to quantify this in relation to the Paris Agreement and what we need to do... So before Paris, we were heading this direction, RCP 8.5, 4 to 6 degrees C of warming, which is just worth bearing in mind. The difference between now and ice age is something like 5 degrees, obviously, in the other direction. But it's that sort of change that you're seeing in really the blink of an eye. And the Paris pledges add up to something like 3 to 4 degrees centigrade. Remember, the pledges themselves, the official period, is only 2020 to 2030. And they're not necessarily all reduction rates. They can be peak rates. They can be sort of... carbon intensity of the economy, there can be all sorts of other ways that they're included. So that's what the rule book at Katowice is supposed to try to clarify. But they're a bit mess, really. But if you try and make some assumptions around them, you look at something like this. And I would argue we should be from 2019, somewhere around 700 billion tonnes, something like that. Basically, zero emissions from energy. This is, I'm not focusing on the other non-CO2 emissions, which we need to come down. I can talk about those if you want to. But the non-CO2 need to come down, but we always have some methane and some N2O emissions if we carry on with agriculture, eating food. So we can't get those to zero. We can probably get them down a long way. I would probably estimate somewhere at 4 to 6 billion tonnes equivalent for the agricultural emissions of feeding 9 billion people. But that's a separate issue to hear. So for energy, zero by 2050. We also signed up on the basis of equity, even though we didn't mean it, which means that the wealthy countries have to do something a little bit ahead of the poorer countries. And that whole sort of common but differentiated responsibility goes right back to really Kyoto and from there. So we repeatedly say that, though it has been weakened in Katowice yet again. So I would argue this is quite a different picture to the euphoria we saw in Paris. And why is that the case? And also, I think quite a lot of the optimism we often see about what we're going to do about climate change. And I think it's because the policymakers have received a very different story. And also, I think they have wanted to receive a very different story. They don't like this one, nor do most of us who work in the area. And their advice has been dominated by a particular group of modellers, who some of you will be familiar with, maybe some of you engage in this, the integrated assessment modelling community. And they bring together simplified climate models with particular types of economic models, normally something along a general equilibrium, near classical growth model, something along those sorts of lines. And then they sort of make some assessment of how you have something like a cost-optimized or a cost-effective solution to climate change. They have much larger carbon budgets that sort of emerge from their analysis with obviously much, much less challenging mitigation. So if you took the scenarios submitted to the IPCC for a 66% chance of 2 degrees centigrade, about 100 or so of them, then they are the median value of something like 600 billion tonnes of CO2. This is from 2017 when you work it out. And you have to compare that with, as I'll show now, 800 from the science in 2017 or sort of heading towards 700 now. So this is obviously a couple of years ago. But the economic modellers are telling us that we've got nearer 1,600. So there's a very big difference between the two. And I think it's quite hard for a lot of people to really understand, well, how can there be such large differences? And those large differences pretty much, this is probably my second favourite climate change film, Dr. Strangelove. It's a really good example of how men love technology, and they're going to use it, not all men, but it's generally men, and they think it's going to solve all these climate change problems or whatever problems he was dealing with, which were not climate change at the time. But I think it captures something about the essence and the approach we have taken to responding to climate change so far. The other film, I think, is Merchants of Doubt, which is a fantastic film, Noemi Oreskes and Eric Conway's movie. The book is excellent, but the film has a lot of different material to the book. Have any of you seen Merchants of Doubt? And it had virtually no circulation. I wonder why. No idea. So what we've done is we're pulling rabbits from hats. We've conjured up, and I think that's still the right term to use at the planetary scale, because we don't have these things. They're still quite conceptual, really, at best, I think. And we've conjured up this whole concept of negative emission technologies. Certainly at scale, we've conjured them up to suck hundreds of billions of tons from the atmosphere at some point in the future. And they say we haven't conjured them up. Well, we've conjured them up, but you're going to have to invent them and get them to work. And we're passing that on to you again. We'll be living in Tuscany, retired by then. Well, perhaps not Tuscany, because it might be a bit too hot. But anyway, perhaps Stockholm. So the emissions go out like this. This is taken again from the sort of median values going out in the 2 degrees C scenarios for IPCC. But what's worrying is that they go way after the end of the century. So because we can't be bothered to do anything here, you know, your children, some of your children, and probably some of your grandchildren will have to be sucking our CO2 out in the atmosphere in the future. So it is worth just thinking about what we're doing here. We're relying on technologies in the future to solve these issues for us. And we're also relying on hopefully not having some additional feedbacks. So Paris, some academics and politicians, rather than focus on urgent and deep mitigation today, rather than question the system, because that has massive political and economic repercussions, we'd rather rely on, at the moment, non-existent technologies to suck hundreds of billions, sometimes up to a trillion tons of CO2 from the air out into the future. If you look at most of the scenarios, they see ongoing use of fossil fuels. There's a great surprise. And basically no major social change required. So business as usual. Davos carries on. I think that's really the framing that we've had that implicitly, sometimes explicitly, informs our thinking around climate change. So if we take away the negative emissions and then start to say, well, what would that look like for the UK? And we've done this now for the UK, we've done it for Sweden, we've done it for quite a few parts of the world, including the EU. We've been feeding into the EU carbon budget debate at the moment. And we've even taken them down to city levels, so we're getting carbon budgets for cities with the huge uncertainties around them. But I think from a policy perspective, it gives us a really clear picture. So for 2 degrees centigrade of warming, we have a global pie. In Manchester, we like pies, so that's why you've got pies here. And if you're Miles Allen, the pie is a bit bigger. And if you're Jason Lowe in the Met Office, the pie is a bit smaller. But the pie is broadly the pie, and we can all argue about quite how big it is, but people take a slightly different view, and you can have these arguments about climate sensitivity and what temperature you start from and a whole host of other things you can embed in there. But basically the Met Office and Miles, if you like, take the two ends of that. But we'll just stick with the AR5 for now until we can get something better. So we've got about 700 billion tonnes, and then we have the simple task of splitting amongst the world's nations. And that's obviously, we're all going to be quite clear and honest about that, aren't we? Just ask for just the right slice size for us, because that's not what happens. There are some interesting, I gather, there's some interesting sort of things in philosophy that help us understand this. If you've got the Chinese negotiate for the European Union, the European Union for Nigeria, Nigeria for the US, then actually your negotiations from that, I understand, will give you a much fairer allocation. It's only when you get people to negotiate for themselves, they always want a bigger slice. So there are ways we could rethink how to do the negotiations if we were serious about climate change. So we asked the question, what's a fair slice for the EU? And that pie could be quite a lot bigger or quite a lot smaller, because you can divide it out on the basis of historical responsibility, population, grandfathered emissions, all sorts of things you can divide it out from. So we've got a range there, but just showing one slice for now. And then we've asked the question, of that, how much would the UK get? And from the UK, we're using, we can go into this later if you want, we use grandfathering. We think grandfathering, once you've gone away from the non-OECD countries, we think grandfathering with an equity coefficient is probably the fairest way of allocating out a very tight budget. Grandfathering means you just look at your recent sort of sets of emissions over the last 5 years or so and take your proportion of the total over that period and use that to allocate out the budget. So there are some reasons why we think that's much fairer. Population's not very fair. We can have arguments about historical responsibility. I think there's some big issues there, but we can talk about that if we need to. But this is within the EU we're doing this now. So grandfathering is what we use. But you still get a big range. Includes aviation and shipping. Excludes imports and exports. So we're not doing consumption-based, even though I think obviously that's a very important set of analysis that needs to be done alongside this, but with much greater uncertainty. And so you end up with a big range, you know, basically 3 to 4 gigatons for the UK. And that probably means nothing to many of you, but if you look at what our emissions are in the UK, if you include aviation and shipping, it's about 7 to 9 years of current emissions. So Miles will say that's what you've got for 1.5 degrees C. Jason would say, well, that's way over 2 degrees C. But you know, so it gives you a flavour of what we would need to be doing. And if you play that out in terms of mitigation rates, it's something well over 10% per annum reduction rates, well over. I mean, I really should put the numbers a bit higher than this. If you play it out, it comes out nearer 15 to 20%. But we sort of always err on the side of being too optimistic, perhaps, even when we're doing this analysis. So something like that. That's a sort of total reduction of something like 75% reduction by about 2025, which is really just tomorrow when you think about it. And fully decarbonised energy system, energy note here, for the UK, but mostly or pretty much all OECD countries will be somewhere between 2035 and 2040 to be zero carbon energy, not low, zero carbon energy. And the non-OECD countries are about 15 years later than that. And within those bounds, some will be later than others. So Germany would be a bit earlier than Greece, and Greece would be a bit later and that sort of thing. And the same within non-OECD. Some countries would have a lot longer, and other countries like China would have to be a lot sooner in the emissions. And we can talk about that later if someone wants to ask you about the numbers behind it all. But that gives you a flavour of what we'd have to try and do. And whichever way you could play with the budgets, it doesn't really move away from the fact we're talking about an order of magnitude rate of mitigation different to anyone else's analysis, pretty much. So it's a complete different agenda to the normal one that we get to hear. So a reasonable question to ask then is, are these rates viable? And I was almost bordering on no until quite recently, about a year and a half ago probably. My colleague, Alice Larkin, previously Bose, she thinks it is impossible. Glenn Peters, one of my colleagues and someone I work with from time to time in Norway, thinks it's impossible. I'm aware that one or two people here who remain nameless think it's impossible as well. And I'm bordering on that, but I'm not quite sure yet. But I think I could envisage how you could deliver on it. And I'm going to try and touch on that in a minute. And it comes back to this issue of equity. The IPCC plus Paris equals equity. That's my sort of question. That goes back to my first opening thought experiment about the big reductions that we could have from a small percentage of the population. CO2 is highly skewed to a small group of the population at a global level. So this is global income deciles. So this is, have you all seen this before? No? Okay. Oh, it's a really useful slide. Never makes it into the IPCC reports. But anyway, that's probably because it is useful. What you have here are income deciles, poorest, the richest, and these are the emissions. And what you see is the poorest 50% are responsible for about 10% of global emissions. This is taken from the work by Lucas Chancellor and Thomas Piketty in 2015. And the infographic was done by Oxfam later on, but it's based on their data. And it's a really interesting methodology. I'd definitely recommend reading the report. It's a really interesting method that they've used to try to take total global emissions and then attribute them to the activities of individuals within the world. So it doesn't take a national approach at all. So if you go to the top 10% here, so most emissions relate to the top group here, as you can imagine. 50% of global emissions come from 10% of the global population. 50% from 10% of the population. And we know who they are. Yeah, academics, climate change audiences, policymakers, business people. We know that 10% are. And we see them when we shave or put our makeup on. That 70% of global emissions come from 20% of the population. So why is it when we have policies, the policies are generally aimed at the whole population and basically squeezing the emissions out of those people that hardly emit? Now, this is a completely different agenda now. It says you've got to tailor your policies to those that emit. What a radical idea. But we don't do that at the moment. We try and squeeze them out of the people that barely emit. And people like me love the idea of a carbon price because professors can just afford it. I can just pay the extra on the price of a flight or a fancy car. A carbon price means nothing to me. But if you live in the fuel poverty homes around Manchester, you can't even afford energy today, let alone a carbon price on top of the energy. So massive equity implications for some of these things. And I would argue when you start to see it like this, that you end up, I would suggest from, I'm not saying what the policies would look like, but if we're serious about anything like a 2 degree C framing, then there's a three-phase strategy you have to have. And I can't see a way out of this, and it's partly because of the time frame issues, coming back to the curves earlier. In the immediate term, you have to have profound changes in the behaviours and the energy-related behaviours and practices of high energy users. That includes consumption, because above a certain threshold, our emissions come out of our consumption rather than out of our energy use. So once you get really above professor levels, then you start to see people's consumption habits are where the energy and the emissions are locked in. That's what's interesting in the methodology that Chancellor Piketty used. So I'm not saying it's going to happen voluntarily. You'd have to have regulations to drive this in some way, but it would be helpful if some people who are in that category started to demonstrate they could do it.
That was part one of a 50-minute lecture at the Oxford Climate Society. Kevin Anderson is chair of Energy and Climate Change at the School of Mechanical, Aerospace and Civil Engineering at the University of Manchester, UK. He spoke on January 25, 2019. Kevin also engages widely across all tiers of governments in Europe. His research is published in Science, Nature, and Nature Geosciences. Come back for part two when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The transcendent experience of street basketball is the topic of two conversations with Onaje Woodbine, the author of Black Gods of the Asphalt, Religion, Hip-Hop, and Street Basketball. Woodbine grew up in the inner city of Roxbury, Massachusetts, became a skilled basketball player, and attended Yale University on a basketball scholarship. After 2 years as a star player on the Yale team, he chose a different life path and quit the basketball team. After graduating from Yale, Woodbine earned his Ph.D. in religious studies from Boston University. His book, Black Gods of the Asphalt, presents a social anthropological view of this inner city sport where the coaches often assume the role of father, mentor, and friend. Woodbine contrasts the lessons he learned on the street basketball courts of Roxbury with those he learned at the predominantly white basketball courts and locker rooms of Yale University. In part two of Onaje Woodbine's phone visit with Radio Curious on August 13, 2016, from his home in Andover, Massachusetts, we begin with his description of the anthropological, ethnographic approach he used to examine street basketball and how he now uses this as a teaching tool in his work.
You know, one of the reasons that I chose ethnography as opposed to another approach to religion, and particularly the religion of people who are living in the inner city and in the streets, is because ethnography forces you to participate in the experience. A lot of social scientists assume they can be objective observers of an experience. And, you know, what I discovered is that language is so limited in describing an experience, you know, because language is an abstraction from experience. And the mistake that a lot of ethnographers can make is that they end up mistaking language for the experience itself, right? And this is what a lot of social scientists do. Right? So they end up imposing a model onto an experience rather than capturing the experience itself. You know, for me, it was very important to sort of live what it means to be on the court, to put my body into that space so that I could avoid stripping this community of its agency and of its feelings and of its experience. So that's why, for me, ethnography is such a powerful way to be a scholar. It's almost like scholarship in action.
Can you describe what that internalized power brings to you individually, understanding what you said, the words that we use, talking now and listening to each other, impose the model on that experience?
Yeah, so, and that was really the hardest part, because on the one hand, I had to use words to make this experience available to many people who have never been on a basketball court, especially in the inner city. So I had to sort of give language so that outsiders could share in this in some way. Right? And at the same time, I had to avoid the very real risk of stripping this community of its freedom and agency. So in a sense, I was sort of functioning as a bridge. I was doing both. And to be in this space, you know, on the court, the feeling was almost overwhelming. You know, I remember walking into a tournament, a streetball tournament in Roxbury that was surrounded by gangs. And, you know, when I walked up to the entry to the actual court, I was terrified. You know, the gang members were around the space. I didn't know what he wanted. I had to sort of turn my body into a pseudo gangster. You know, I got really sort of tough. I walked with a little limp. I didn't look people in the eye. You know, but at the same time, when I entered the court, when I passed through that gateway that separates the court from the street, there was this huge moment of relief. You know, I felt the weight of the world just come off my shoulders, and, you know, I was on the court. It turned into a refuge, you know. And so it was powerful for me to subject myself to those forces that for many of the guys, it's unconscious. And that's, you know, I think what was so powerful for me was sort of turning what I had already experienced growing up into an object of study, you know. And my hope was that in doing so, I'd give myself language to try to understand what was happening, but also give my community, you know, a perspective on themselves that they may not have had prior.
What was that perspective that you hoped to share with your community?
What looks to be a common practice is actually uncommon. You know, I wanted to turn the common into the uncommon. I wanted them to realize and to recognize, and outsiders to recognize, that they're asking pretty universal questions in these spaces. Right? These are not just guys who want to make it to the NBA. They're not just motivated by external, you know, economic or racial reasons. That they're asking pretty deep human questions here, questions that we all ask, you know, such as, you know, what happens when somebody gets murdered? Where does their spirit go? If they have, do we have spirits? Why is there evil in the world? I mean, why are people getting shot in my neighborhood? And, you know, is there a good God? I mean, would God let that happen? You know, what is my purpose? Who am I? You know, what does it mean to be a descendant of slaves? You know, those kinds of experiences and questions are often overlooked in this community by outsiders. And over time, they almost forget in the sense that they don't really realize that they're asking, you know, these kinds of questions in the inner city. And so my hope was to show, you know, the power of the human spirit, even in a space where most people think, you know, it would be extinguished.
So when you say those questions, and I certainly, in my experience, have never heard the answers, what does it mean from the perspective of an outsider?
You know, I think that most people assume, you know, who've never lived in the inner city, that, you know, when they see a group of young black men on a basketball court or just walking or on the street corner, that they're being motivated by economic reasons, or they're being exploited, you know, because of their racial and gender makeup. You know, on the one hand, you have sort of liberals who think that, you know, well, these people are determined by poverty and race, and so how can we help them out of this? And then on the other hand, you have more conservative thinkers who say, yes, they're being determined by race, but it's partly, you know, their own fault, and so forth. And really, nobody wants to talk about sort of the agency and the deeper human qualities and feelings and experiences of these folks. That, yes, you know, they are determined by, you know, their external environment and circumstances, but there's freedom there, you know, just like we all have. You know, there's humanity there. And so, you know, that's what I wanted to show. I wanted to pull back the veil of our assumptions so that, in a sense, we could see ourselves in people we normally might dismiss.
When you say nobody wants to talk about it,
yes,
are those the players on the basketball team or the outsiders?
I would say mostly the outsider.
So then let me ask you this.
Yes.
What does it mean to be a descendant of slaves?
Powerful question. You know, and I wouldn't want to answer for everyone, but, you know, one of the things that I found on the court and in these spaces is that it certainly is an injury. It raises more questions about who am I than it answers. It represents, for many young men, an absence in knowledge of self. You know, it's like, does my history start from the moment of slavery? Is there anything prior to that? And if there is, how do I ever access it or become aware of it? You know, I don't know the language that I spoke before or that my ancestors spoke before they arrived in the New World. I don't know which part of Africa I come from. So who am I, really? You know, and so that question raises a lot of identity issues. For some, it feels like an injury. It feels like, you know, it allows for self-doubt to creep in, anger at, you know, those who, and it, you know, who you might perceive sort of did the injury or, you know, are sort of responsible. And so, you know, you have a lot of this ongoing anger and inner turmoil as a result of that injury that's never been really addressed, you know, by the larger culture.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we are talking in our part two of our conversation with Onaje Woodbine, author of Black Gods of the Asphalt, religion, hip-hop, and street basketball. Vinaje Woodbine is a teacher of philosophy and religion at the Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Vinaje, I'd like to stay with this issue of questions.
Yes.
And ask you about the questions that it has raised in you as an individual, to which you've been able to find answers over the course of your youth, your adolescence as a basketball player, your experience in Yale, your experience receiving a PhD, the studies that worked for that, and where you are now in this station in your life.
Now, thank you for that question, Barry. You know, what I discovered both through my own experience and also through, you know, many conversations with young African-American men on the basketball court is that because there is no physical place where, you know, African-Americans can go to necessarily and say, you know, this is my origin, that they have often done it, and I have as well. They often return to a kind of origin in their consciousness, and it often happens at the level of religion, right? or the level of the imagination. And so, the sort of source of freedom is in sense of wholeness. Is not this physical place, but a place in the imagination. And this happens on the basketball court in large part in terms of ancestors. You know, when somebody dies, the guys who are still living go on the court in dialogue with that person's spirit through the game of basketball. You know, when they make a shot, they attribute that to the spirit's presence. Right? And so for me, it's no coincidence that descendants of slaves would be encountering ancestors through their imagination on the basketball court as a form of healing. I can't physically go to the gravesite of somebody who was a slave. Of all of my ancestors who remain nameless, for all of those people who jumped over the ship during the Middle Passage. But in my spirit, I can communicate with them and therefore experience a form of healing and a kind of healing that nobody can take away because it's transcendent. It's not of this world. And so I think that's what's happening for many of these guys on the basketball court and for, you know, many people of African descent or descendants of slaves in general, is that they're being very creative at the level of what we might call a religious imagination.
So again, using language as an abstraction from experience.
Yes.
And imposing a model on those experiences. Could you share with us some of your experiences that you have considered?
Yeah, sure. So I had the opportunity to travel to Nigeria while I was in graduate school. And I was reading Invisible Man at the time, which added another layer to my experience. But, you know, I sat down at the feet of several shamans almost as soon as I had landed in Nigeria, because I ended up living in the house of a shaman. And I didn't tell them anything about me, but they proceeded to read me like an open book. You know, they told me about my life and the problems I was having and potential solutions. And then they debated sort of, you know, the solutions in a very philosophical manner amongst themselves And it was the most profound thing for me that, you know, this group of, you know, Nigerians from the Yoruba tradition had this very intellectual, highly philosophical tradition that was indigenous to this community, and that they had knowledge of me that, you know, I hadn't shared with them. And that experience changed my perception of myself, but it also gave me a perspective on my ancestors, you know, and the kind of beauty and culture and intellectual traditions that we contributed to the world. Because growing up, I had always been told that Africans had not given anything to the world. So I realized that was a lie. And that was just such a powerful moment in my own awakening and healing process. And then, you know, the second thing that I'll share is on the basketball court itself. You know, when I lost my coach and I lost other people in inner city Roxbury, I withdrew from the world, and I'll describe myself as being shattered and, like, broken into many pieces. And when I began to meditate on the basketball court, I would turn the game into a moving meditation. You know, I would be out there for hours holding the ball, you know, moving up and down the court, finding a rhythm, finding a flow, interacting with my innermost thoughts and feelings. It was as if the court itself became a kind of glue for myself. It brought the pieces of myself back together again. It's like I could recreate or restore, you know, myself there. And I also communicated with Manny, you know, my coach who had passed away in that space. And the two experiences that I've shared are related because years later when I went to Nigeria, I realized that the rituals that I had seen in Nigeria were very similar to what was happening, in inner city basketball.
What is it about the basketball court itself as opposed to other gatherings of young men?
Yes. You know, within the inner city at least, the basketball court itself, the physical space, is very symbolic. The lines represent the distinction between the streets, the everyday life of violence in the streets, and something greater. In between the lines, you can be something else. You can be something more. The other thing that is symbolic is that around the court during the street ball tournaments are the names and faces of mostly young men who have died too young and before their time. And then you have the names of the tournaments themselves posted around the physical space. Names like Save Our Streets, or See Murder Tournament, or Community Awareness Tournament, Manny Wilson Memorial. So the artwork, the choreography of the games themselves give it an air of seriousness. That what is being done here is of vital importance, you know, and requires our commitment and deep attention. And let me say the other important piece is the music. You know, the beat. There's always a DJ, you know, who is keeping the rhythm of the space, and the music is so loud that you hardly can hear yourself think or breathe. All you can do is feel in that space and get caught in caught in the moment of it, and you sort of lose yourself, you know, and you forget about the troubles of the world, you know. So it, you know, the court in Roxbury is turned into this vehicle for the elevation of your awareness, you know, of who you are and why you're here. You know, which was very different than, you know, a Yale practice.
Well, Najee Woodbine, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about you. The first one is, can you tell us about an aha or eureka moment that changed your personal life, your view of the world, that affects the way you live now?
Yes. So I'm not sure if it was a moment, but more a process of becoming aware that if I go deep enough into myself, I can find the world. It's the idea that there's no difference between what is in me and what is outside of me. You know, I discovered through the process of writing the book, right, that all I have to do is look within. What problems are affecting me? What questions does my personal story raise? And through that process of self-discovery, what really shocked me was that I found problems that are in the world, right, that everybody is experiencing and attempting to address in some way. So that has been the real insight for me, is really that we are all, in a sense, human, you know, and this is why I think thinking about social change has to be nonviolent. To hurt the other is to hurt myself. So that, for me, is the ethical implication of my discovery. Right? Is that if the other is me, in a very real sense, right? Then, you know, I have to care and treat for the other, even if they are, you know, my so-called enemy. I have to love them as if I love myself. And that, you know, was really a profound discovery that I made through the ethnography and through the whole process of writing the book.
And Onajee Woodbine, what would you like to do with the rest of your one precious life?
I want to be a choreographer of consciousness. I want to design experiences and move physical movement that brings people together and addresses trauma. I want to be a janitor of space. I want to provide spaces or where people find doorways to healing. But, you know, ultimately, you know, I believe that my purpose and my goal is to invite people to see that there's humanity in what they would think of as unexpected places or strange places.
And finally, Onajee Woodbine, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
The book, you know, I'm not a Christian, but one of the books that has been the most inspiring to me is Howard Thurman's Jesus and the Disinherited. And in Thurman's Jesus and the Disinherited, many people think that Martin Luther King carried this book in his back pocket during the Civil Rights Movement. Thurman argues that the key to resistance of violence, to oppression, is the knowledge that nobody can make you hate another person. Nobody can make you feel a particular way. That you are the guardian and the authority over your inner life.
Onaje Woodbine, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Onaje Woodbine is the author of Black Gods of the Asphalt, Religion, Hip-Hop, and Street Basketball. You may hear part one of our visit with Onaje Woodbine at radiocurious.org. And the book he recommends is Jesus and the Disinherited by Howard Thurman. This interview was recorded on August 13, 2016. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.